You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Richard Cahan. He is a journalist who writes about photography, art, and history. He worked for the Chicago Sun-Times from 1983 to 1999, primarily serving as the paper's picture editor. He left to found and direct City 2000, a project that documented Chicago in the year 2000, and since then he has authored and co-authored more than a dozen books, including the one we are going to talk about this week. Together with Michael Williams, he has just published Un-American: The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. Richard Cahan, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks for coming on. This is a wonderful book, primarily a collection of photographs. How did this come about?
Well, it came about because of my interest in the incarceration of Japanese Americans. Like most people, I didn't hear much about it in high school or college. Somehow we talked about Yalta, and we talked about Normandy and Pearl Harbor, but the subject of the incarceration of Japanese Americans really never came up, and I've always been interested in it. Last year, I was at the National Archives in College Park, Maryland, where it's kind of, I'm sure people know, it's the government's repository of photographs and textual material, and I was in the what's called the still picture branch, and I was looking at photographs that the government had taken. Government had hired photographers to take pictures of the incarceration, and that got me very interested.
And that's what this book is made up of, is photographs that the government hired photographers to take of its own action against Japanese Americans. Is that right?
Exactly right, yes.
Why do that?
You know, that's a great question. At the time, it was fashionable for the government to hire photographers to document and, I assume, promote their work. Your listeners probably know about the Farm Security Administration photos of the 1930s, where the government was building homes for people who were migrating from places like Arkansas in the Midwest to California. They did this for many years, and then in early 1942, Dorothea Lange, very famous documentary photographer who worked for the Farm Security Administration, apparently talked to the new director of the War Relocation Authority, an alphabet agency that was set up during the war to oversee the incarceration, and apparently convinced him that it was worth documenting. By doing that, the government had photos they could use, and the government also had an excuse to keep other photographers out. If a newspaper called and said they wanted to send a photographer to see the conditions of a certain camp, that the government could say, well, we've already got photographs and we're happy to send them to you.
That's a very good point. But these photographs are by some very well-known and very talented photographers. Who are the photographers involved here?
Well, the main photographer in the book is Dorothea Lange, and people know her, I'm sure, from her pictures of her famous picture of the migrant mother that was taken in California of the mother surrounded by her destitute children in a shanty in California. And I don't think that they had any sense of who they hired when they hired Dorothea Lange. She was feisty, and she had a conscience, and she had this remarkable ability, like the migrant mother photo, to get up really close to people and show their faces and their fears and their pride and their, what they were thinking. So they kind of got more than they bargained for with her. The other photographers, there was a photojournalist from San Francisco by the name of Clem Albers. They hired him for a couple of months, and another photographer by the name of Francis Stewart. And all three of them were kind of a little too radical for them, and then they kind of settled on more traditional kind of government photographers. A man by the name of Tom Parker and a man by the name of Charles Mace were the main photographers.
And then another very well-known name that shows up on the cover of the book is Ansel Adams.
Exactly. And Ansel Adams wasn't really a government photographer, but we put him in the book because he was authorized to photograph at one camp, Manzanar, in Central California. And he then donated his photographs to the Library of Congress. So in a sense, these pictures are similar to the government pictures in that they're open to the public. Anyone could see them, anyone could study them, and anyone could use them. And we thought his pictures were important. They contrasted Dorothea Lange's pictures. She showed fear, and she showed the first days of the incarceration when people were actually being picked up and taken away. And he arrived at camp about a year later and really showed the pride and the dignity that Japanese Americans had kind of carved out a year later.
The book does tell quite a story in that the photographs go from before the forced removal and incarceration to after. And in the before pictures, I was a little bit surprised, I admit, to see not just pictures of Japanese with farms, but Japanese with apparently Beverly Hills mansions.
Yeah.
This cut across class lines. This was an action against people of some wealth, and one would assume power.
Exactly. No, I agree with you. I think those there's several pictures at the start of the book of very nice homes in Los Angeles, and I think they're surprising. They run against the stereotype of the working, farming Japanese Americans that were you know exiled to the field. I think that's one of the values of the book. They look so. Can I ask you? They look so American, don't they? You know, and that's because they really were American. We were very careful.
I don't have the slightest idea what that means, actually.
I mean that they look traditionally middle class.
In fact, throughout the book, they look middle class and, suit and tie and hat and, the way people used to dress.
Right,
and
leather belts and. Jeans. I think that's important for people to realize that, not that it matters, but that of the 110, not that it matters how they feel, but of the 110,000 Japanese Americans who were forcibly removed, over 60,000 of them, close to 70,000, were U.S. citizens. They were born in America. They had no, specific allegiance to Japan, and that's important for people to realize that these were people, like you and I. And that's one of the reasons why we use the word incarceration instead of the more traditional internment, because you can't incarcerate, in legal terms, citizens. U.S. citizens. So this whole idea that this was an internment is really a lie, and it's a use of language to cover up that lie. This truly was an imprisonment and a... in an incarceration.
Yeah, though in today's degraded standards, when the talk is of capturing rather than arresting or interning or incarcerating, people who are treated as animals, and we've grown used to the photos we see out of Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, there's nothing like that in this book. There's no torturing people to death. There's no degrading of people with nude photos and electric shock equipment. Those people, I think, are humans like you and I as well, even if they don't look like it in those more recent photos. But in this book, it seems to me easier to recognize these people, but also to ask, what was the harm? This looks okay. This doesn't look cruel by today's standards.
Well, imagine for a moment, and the government made a big effort to show and to claim that this was very humane. But imagine for a moment. If you were told that in 9 days or in a week you would be picked up and you would be taken away, maybe for a week or a month or a year or forever, to a place that you had no idea where you were going to be taken away at, and you had a week to basically settle your affairs, sell your house, sell your possessions, sell your tractor, sell your farms, so this was not in any way an easy experience for this. This was traumatic. It still affects these people who are very much, many of them who are very much alive today.
Yeah, we're speaking with Richard Cahan, who's a co-author of Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. I think the photos are helped as well by the text that you and Michael Williams added, including explaining what's happening. There's a photograph of a Japanese man showing a tractor to a couple right. of, I guess you would call them white Americans. Talk about what's happening there.
Right. Well, in this photograph, this was the photograph that was actually taken by Russell Lee, who is a very famous government photographer, not associated with the War Relocation Authority, but somebody who worked for the government, actually the Farm Security Administration. He took this photograph. And what's happening is this man in rural California is selling his tractor days before he's about to be picked up. And another man, we quoted another man who is not in the picture, but his name is Yasuko Ito. He said, "It is difficult to describe the feeling of despair and humiliation experienced by all of us as we watch the Caucasians coming to look over our possessions and offering such nominal amounts." So they were being paid very little on the dollar for what they had. And you mentioned that it wasn't degrading, but, you know, there certainly is an element of degrading in this and humiliation.
Yeah. Yeah, and we now know, if it wasn't known then, that the actual motivations behind this program included the greed of the white farmers wanting that farmland. Isn't that right?
It did. Japanese Americans had a very rough relationship with who they called Caucasians in California. There were laws that prevented those who came from Japan from becoming citizens. It couldn't prevent their offspring who were born in America from that. Laws that prevented them from owning land. So oftentimes their relatives or their children had to own land. We saw a lot of race prejudice as we read through this book. Very few people wrote letters to the editors. Very few organizations stood up for these people. And obviously all this was tinged by, you know, war hysteria. We tend to make very irrational decisions. We, as Americans or as human beings, when we're worried about things, when security is our main worry, and it, in a way, this book looks at what happens when fear eclipses civil liberty. And finally, and in the 1980s, when the government studied what happened here, they concluded that it was race prejudice, war hysteria, and the failure of political leadership. Those are the three main causes of the incarceration.
Yeah, it's interesting that the U.S. government, the U.S. Congress, you know, did a study and concluded that it was racism with a pretense of being something otherwise, of being defensive against an actual danger, that there was any actual evidence needed to be feared.
Right. We had this unique opportunity. We found a couple of dozen people who were subjects of these photographs. Most of them had no idea that they were even taken. This happened 75 years ago, but they're still alive, and so they helped us put the photos in context. But what we also did is we looked at local newspapers, very local newspapers, around the dates that these people were picked up and taken away. And we found many editorials where newspapers looked forward to the day that the, quote, Japanese problem would be over, and finally, you know, we, quote, would get our land back, and they would be taken away forever. It was shocking that this happened. You know, remember, this isn't ancient history. These are contemporary times. Most of these people are still alive who were about. So,
yeah,
it was chilling.
In Pearl Harbor, of course, served as part of the motivation for that, and has served as one of the primary motivations for war after war after war after war for 75 years.
Right.
And, you know, I know there's talk now of Muslim registries. There were lists of Japanese Americans and other American immigrants for decades leading up to this, and the decisions made by Franklin Roosevelt after Pearl Harbor. But what I've read, and I don't think you mentioned this in the book, on November 26, 1941, that is a week before Pearl Harbor, Franklin Roosevelt secretly ordered someone named Henry Field to create a list of Japanese Americans. Are you familiar with that?
I am familiar with that. The machinery had started before, you know, Pearl Harbor. As you mentioned, I think, on your blog, within 48 hours, there were already 1,200 Japanese-Americans picked up. And so they knew exactly who they were going with for. And like most lists that are compiled by places like the FBI or government agencies, it was a ridiculous list. It included basically all religious, you know, all Buddhist figures. It included Chamber of Commerce leaders. It included people who subscribed to Japanese magazines or who were members of Japanese organizations. So it was a very, very inaccurate list. And I'm pretty sure that those kind of lists are being made right now.
We know that President Obama today, as we speak, canceled one Muslim registry. There's another extant, and there's a president-elect threatening to create a new one.
Right.
How have people failed to learn this lesson? I mean, didn't the U.S. government actually apologize and pay reparations for this and consider it now to have been a crime?
They did. In 1988, President Reagan formally apologized, and all the survivors were given $20,000 reparation checks, tax-free. But this is a story that people don't want to remember. I actually spent this weekend, I was in Arizona. There were two internment camps located there. And trying to find the remains of these camps, it didn't prove impossible. I did find them. But you know, you think that everything is findable on the internet, but that failed me, and it literally took me luck. I was lucky to find people in the area who could go back and show me the few foundations, the remains of these camps. The National Park Service does designate some of these camps as important historic treasures, monuments, but most of them have been forgotten. Foundations, weeds, ancient ruins. There's no great hue and cry to keep these alive so that they serve as a reminder for people in the future.
Yeah, 10 of them were made historical landmarks by Congress in 2001. Doesn't mean they're being celebrated locally where they are, or not celebrated, but memorialized.
Right. I'm sure someone from the National Park Service would disagree with me, but I think it's a minor effort, in my opinion, to, you know, save the memory of these camps.
What should they do?
Well, I think they should be, there should be signs at the minimum that you are now, you know, passing this site. There's been attempts and good attempts to recreate some of the barracks, at least one barrack in some of the camps, but most of the camps are pretty forgotten by now. I think this is an important part of American history that we find very easy to forget.
There is a sort of a kind of a mixed message memorial in marble in Washington, D.C., a little bit out of the way near the Teamsters office on the way over to the train station that seems to celebrate on the one hand that Japanese Americans patriotically and murderously participated in World War II on the U.S. side, but also recognizes the crime of this mass incarceration. And there's a quote from Daniel Inouye, the U.S. senator, that says, "The lessons learned must remain as a grave reminder of what we must not allow to happen again to any group," end quote. What do you make of that effort of memorialization?
You know, I don't know about the Washington, D.C. Monument, but I do know that one thing that I learned in this book, and it seems so obvious, one of the takeaways, was that we have problems in America even figuring out who exactly our enemy is. Our enemy is, for instance, in World War II, were not Japanese Americans or German Americans or Italian Americans. Our enemy was the government of Japan and Germany and Italy. And sometimes we transfer the fact that someone is, from Japan to the fact that all of a sudden he's an enemy. These people consider themselves Americans. They, they worked hard to be Americans, fit into society, and somehow we can't even separate. It doesn't seem that hard to figure out that if we are going to determine that we have enemies, and I'm not naive enough to think that America doesn't have enemies, we should be very clear on who the enemies are.
Well, I am that naive. I think we should stop imagining enemies in the world. But no, if you,
I am too, David. But most people aren't.
Well, most people are a problem and are are endangering our species' future. But to take to play devil's advocate, you know, for those who want to find enemies and protect themselves at all costs, even if it kills them, you know, there was one Japanese American on Hawaii who assisted a Japanese pilot who landed on a small island after attacking Pearl Harbor. And there are Muslim Americans today who claim that their acts of violence are motivated as blowback against U.S. wars and occupations in Muslim countries abroad. I mean, there is always some grain of truth to hang that on, isn't there?
There is, but do you incarcerate 110,000 people because of the worry of one or two or a few? And do you separate people and take away their civil liberties? I mean, we have a constitution that guarantees that people can't be detained and incarcerated unless there is true evidence to justify it. That didn't happen here. So, I think we've got to be very careful in figuring out what America is really all about. It is an amazing experiment, and it's a scary experiment. But I think most people think it's a worthwhile experiment.
Well, I think this book is a worthwhile contribution to showing people what this looked like to quote unquote humanizing it, giving the people involved faces. I find the photo on the cover to be powerful in that it shows Japanese Americans looking out of train windows. Right. Was there an intentional connection to all of the trains in Europe taking the Jews to camps?
Oh, absolutely. I think that it's exactly why we chose this picture. And it's interesting that this was in Woodland, California, and I had a chance to visit the train station that's still there. And it's so interesting to understand what happened that day. And we had a chance to look at the Woodland Democrat. It wrote about how people stood waiting for the train, listening to jazz, a radio station, listening to jazz on a radio station. And one family arrived about a half hour late. They offered no explanation, and then the train took off. And there's pictures in the book of both people on the train crying, and I think what makes this book particularly valuable is that it gives us a visual history. And for many people, they can read. There's great novels, and there's great books on the incarceration, but when you actually see the pictures, it helps you go back to that moment and that scene and connect with the people. And I know as I wrote the book, I kept on asking myself, what would I have done? How would I have stood up? Or would I have stood up? And I think that's what people get as they look at this book. They question.
Yeah, and will they stand up now?
Right.
There were camps in the United States for Native Americans that actually were an inspiration to the Nazis, and the treatment of the Native people of California was, of course, horrific. In this case, these are people being put on trains, but not sent to ovens, right? Not sent to be killed.
These were concentration camps. They were concentrating this group of people. These were not death camps. And really, we usually refer to the concentration camps as the Nazi concentration camps. They should really be called death camps. They should be death concentration camps.
Yeah. And here we are. We have a few minutes left. I wonder about the current situation, ill-informed of this recent history, in that we've created a camp on Guantanamo, Cuba, that does. Apart from CIA murders and tortures to death there, that does lock people up without any process, any charge or conviction. And
a president-elect coming in promising to put more people there.
Right.
And yet you see resistance to the idea of creating a Muslim registry, even on the part of Silicon Valley high tech companies, the idea that if you're going to do it in that way on the basis of race or religion, it's unacceptable. Have we progressed or regressed? Where are we?
Well, I don't know. I think it could be fairly argued that Guantanamo is different because. What I think makes this book so important is that there were 60,000 U.S. citizens here. I'm saddened by the, quote, Japanese nationals who weren't citizens who were taken away. Unfortunately, being a national, an enemy alien or an alien enemy during a time of war gives you very few rights. And if you just happen to be in a country when war breaks out, wherever you are in the world, you have very few rights. So I think that the real look, the real tragedy here is that it happened to two American citizens. And the Constitution was just simply thrown out. There's talk now, there was a Trump supporter talking on Fox News about how the Muslim registry has a precedent, and that precedent is the internment of Japanese Americans. And most
right.
people in the know shook their head, and they said, precedent? Well, I would argue from looking at the book that there is a precedent there, but it's a bad precedent. And all someone has to do is look at this book or read these accounts to understand that this was a road that the United States took that was not a good place, a good road to follow.
Or the first President Bush apologizing on Pearl Harbor Day, or the United States government paying reparations. But there are some constitutional scholars who point out that you can't actually find in the Constitution that its rights are limited to U.S. citizens. And, of course, some ethicists who would argue that abuse of human beings is equivalent, regardless of whether or not they are U.S. citizens. And
right.
and there were Japanese put in these camps who had been in this country for decades, right? They weren't permitted to become citizens.
Exactly.
Only by being born here could they become citizens.
Right. There were specific laws enacted to make sure that they could never become U.S. citizens.
Right. So this was a massive crime that is largely forgotten, despite the government having gone to this beautiful effort that you've now brought to us to document its own criminal activity.
Right. No, I agree. These are important lessons that people need to learn.
Do you think a similar? I don't know what you're working on next. You probably have some other books in the works. But do you think a collection of photographs of Muslim Americans would do any good at this point?
I think it would do a lot of good. I think it's important for people to look into people's faces and see that we all have the same blood, that we all have the same desires and smiles, frowns, and worries. And yes, so. Ansel Adams has been criticized that he made these Japanese Americans look too human at the time. He was criticized for that. And that's, I don't agree. I think it's really important that we look into their eyes. I think when people open this book and they see those first portraits that he took, they say, oh my gosh, this could be me.
I very much hope so. I recommend it to everybody. Get it for a holiday present or otherwise. On American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II by Richard Kahan and Michael Williams. Richard Kahan, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much, David. I appreciate it.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
for listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to the Best of Counterspin for 2016. I'm Janine Jackson. Counterspin is, of course, your weekly look behind the headlines, but at year's end, we take a look back and revisit some of the stories it's been our privilege to bring you. We call it the best of, but the truth is we are always working to bring you voices and perspectives that corporate media ignore, or worse, and to shed some behind-the-scenes light on why so-called mainstream news looks the way it does. Expanding the public conversation, listening to people who don't make the nightly news, has always been crucial. Right now, more people may be recognizing that, and that's a good thing. Counterspin is brought to you each and every week by the Media Watch Group Fair. There is an understandable inclination to divide 2016 into before and after November 8th. But Donald Trump and Trumpism didn't just spring into life at that point. Early in the year, we were talking white supremacy with Heidi Beirich, leader of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center, who told us that some reporters think they're helping by not reporting.
Oftentimes when I talk to journalists, they have this inclination to not want to write about hate groups, hate ideology, either because they think that's going to draw attention to these groups that's undeserved, make them seem perhaps larger than they are, have more impact. You know, in general, I reject that way of thinking. I think that we actually have to talk about these organizations and these beliefs seriously and whenever they come up. And the reason is this: the United States has a horrific history of white supremacy, white violence, domestic terrorism predicated on these beliefs. I mean, people seem to forget that it's only in the mid-60s that black folks in the United States were accorded the same rights as white people. And so if you aren't talking about white supremacy, you're sort of ignoring one of the main facets of American society. And I have to say that, you know, over the last few weeks with the Trump Klan controversy, these various incidents at Trump rallies, I mean, you realize that this is still a potent driving factor in United States politics and society. It needs to be talked about and talked about often. Look, you know, we are not about violating anybody's First Amendment rights. Our role, you know, at the Southern Poverty Law Center, and I think really for all good citizens, is to counter hate speech with speech. In other words, use our First Amendment rights, just as, you know, a hate group might be exercising it by putting out an idea of white genocide or something like that, but to use our First Amendment rights to point out what's wrong about that thinking, where that kind of thinking can lead, and once again, you know, point out what the history of racial violence has been like in this country. That's what needs to happen. So, you know, I encourage people to speak out about these ideas, to counter these ideas. You know, that is very, very important to reducing their power.
For a while, it seemed the story of the year would be how the city of Flint, Michigan, poisoned its largely African-American citizens with undrinkable water. Counterspin spoke with Michigan reporter Chris Savage, publisher of eclectablog.com, about the politics behind the fiasco.
Essentially, what happened with emergency managers is that they replaced the local elected officials. They were actually able to fire local elected officials if they chose to do so and replace them on their city councils or whatever the local governing body was, and that did happen in some cities. But it was basically an abridgment of democracy. It was taking away power from elected officials and handing it over to a single person who's appointed by the governor, and that person made all of the decisions. So this finger-pointing at local officials is quite laughable, quite frankly, because these people really had no power. The emergency manager had the final say on everything, and that's why we're pointing the finger at people like Darnell Early and other people in the Snyder administration, because they literally ran the city, and, you know, you can't take control of a city and take credit for all of the things that happen that you consider to be good, but then shirk responsibility for any of the things that go horribly wrong. And in this case, this is really the most epically, horribly bad thing that could happen under an emergency manager, is poisoning of the city's residents.
It's been noted that cities under emergency managers, as Chris Lewis in The Atlantic wrote it, cities under emergency managers contain just 9% of Michigan's population, but about half the state's African-American residents.
I was actually the person that broke that story, to be honest with you. You know, when I did the calculations, once Detroit got an emergency manager, literally over half of the African-Americans did not have locally elected Democratic government. It's a shocking statistic.
Well, I appreciate that because that is, it's still kind of on the back burner in terms of coverage of this story, but it seems important. It's hard to miss that this anti-democratic method is being carried out in a place and in places that, number one, the state is already disinvested from, you know, and then, as sure. you've just said, that it's overwhelmingly African-Americans who are being deprived of political rights.
That's right. And the people who defend emergency management will point to, you know, corruption and malfeasance and incompetence in these areas. And their position is that emergency managers are needed to sort of cut through all of this corruption and incompetence and make hard decisions that local officials aren't incapable of making. But there's a few things wrong with that. One is that local officials don't have the ability to do some of the things that emergency managers are capable of doing, like forcing unions to renegotiate their contracts. But it also forces people to, you know, have to, they don't have constituents anymore. I mean, these emergency managers are only responsible to the state. And they're only armed with tools of what I call destruction instead of construction and renewal. They're not able to do things that will increase revenues, for example, in cities. They can only cut costs, and that's where corners get cut, and that's where things happen.
Discriminatory policing stayed on the front burner this year. We spoke with Alvaro Bedoya, executive director of the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law, about the role of new technologies of surveillance in a very old struggle.
What many in government and what a lot of folks in the private sector are arguing for now is a world where we no longer have that choice, where instead of protecting privacy at the point of collection, privacy is purportedly collected after the fact. And the real problem here is that who is making those decisions about how your information is used? Companies, the government. And for years and years, there is a sad and deep record of companies and the government making very poor decisions about how to treat the information of vulnerable people. The government, for example, during World War II, used census data that was supposedly only going to be used for the census to figure out where Japanese Americans were living, to track them down and detain them in internment camps. Nowadays, you have data brokers who are literally creating lists of individuals who are HIV positive or individuals who are victims of sexual assault or who have diabetes or Parkinson's disease. These are lists that, by and large, aren't going to help the people on those lists.
Right. They're selling those to...
To rip people off. That's right.
So they're selling them to companies. Just to be clear, they're collecting this data and selling it to companies who might then sell things to those people, or...
Data brokers do this, and sometimes they are marketed to other companies that sell them things. Sometimes they're actually literally purchased by fraud rings that call people up and enter them into a series of sweepstakes and other basically fraudulent enterprises that bilk them of thousands upon thousands of dollars. And frankly, we don't know what we don't know about this industry because it is unregulated. And so when I say privacy is a shield for the weak, privacy allows vulnerable people to go about their business and also make choices about their lives without powerful government entities or corporate entities second-guessing them on it and looking over their shoulder and saying, don't do this, do that, or using their data in a way that might harm them. There's no discussion of the fact that for almost the entirety of our nation's history, the Black community and people of color in general have been the disproportionate targets of unjust surveillance. People might know about Martin Luther King and how the FBI surveilled him. People don't know that the NSA also wiretapped him, and they might not know that it wasn't just Martin Luther King. It was Fannie Lou Hamer. It was Whitney Young of the National Urban League. It was Cesar Chavez. Before that, it was W.E.B. Du Bois and Marcus Garvey. And before that, enslaved people in our country, in cities like New York, for example, literally could not walk outside after dark without carrying a lantern on them so that everyone could see them. These were called lantern laws. And fast forward all the way to this day, and I realize I'm covering about 300 years of history in about six breaths and four sentences, but today activists with Black Lives Matter And journalists have revealed that the Department of Homeland Security, an agency founded to combat terrorism, is using its resources to monitor Black Lives Matter, even entirely peaceful activities. And so the purpose of this conference is to bring these communities and bring these conversations together and show that in a world where everyone's watched, everyone is not watched equally. And we need to reckon with that as a society and in Congress.
Rex Tillerson has been chosen as Secretary of State, presumably based on his record of leading ExxonMobil, presumably including that corporation's leading role in stymieing research and awareness on climate disruption. DeSmog Blog's Brendan DeMel works on that issue. He talked to us about what Exxon knew when.
Imagine where the world would be if Exxon had continued to pursue that research and embrace its own scientific understanding of climate change decades ago. But as we know, rather than doing that, they pivoted antagonistically against the science and started funding decades of denial and deception, individuals and think tanks that they were pumping money into to confuse the public and policymakers about the importance of addressing climate change. And that, again, goes in parallel with the tactics of the tobacco industry in evading accountability for its own deadly product and knowledge of cancer and other health effects from its products, which was to sow doubt. But they knew that they could evade accountability or at least delay regulatory and public scrutiny by suggesting that there was doubt about the science. So they created their own institutes that sounded credible. They created their own science that undermined what was known in the peer-reviewed literature in the health community about the impacts. And the oil companies followed that playbook, you know, to a T, and used the same sort of tactics to suggest that, oh, well, we're not sure yet. You know, let's study this further. Let's take time before regulatory action addresses this problem. So it was essentially the exact same tactic, and regulators and certainly policymakers bought it,
right,
unfortunately. And that's right. Led us to the situation we're in, where climate change is having very real impacts now. You know, we're seeing them presently, and the delay that was caused by this deceptive campaign by Exxon and the Global Climate Coalition and other major oil companies is a real reason why we haven't addressed this aggressively. It's been discouraging to see the media, you know, other fellow journalists who are saying, oh yeah, didn't we know that story? Even when the Inside Climate stuff came out, which was explosive, you know, incredible work, the first reactions among a lot of the mainstream journalists was, oh yeah, we knew that already. We're right. Not going to cover that. Well, no, you didn't. You know, this was a lot of hard work and gumshoe journalism to dig up these documents and show definitively, using the industry's own words, what was known. And so, again, I mean, here we are, DeSmog, we put this story up this week. You know, sure, we're seeing great traffic from it, but what I really want to see is everybody else jump on. Like, there is a lot of work to be done here. There are more documents to be found. There's more hard questions to be asked. You know, Imperial Oil ignored us. They didn't respond to my due diligence questions. You know, so there's plenty of meat on this bone for other journalists to pick, and I certainly hope that, you know, editors worldwide will figure that out and get more people on the job.
There are stories media yawn at and those they breathlessly hype. In May, a so-called gang raid in the Bronx, with involvement by Homeland Security, the FBI, and the BATF, garnered stories that dispensed with allegedlies and with community voices. To tell a story that would make a pre-dawn invasion with agents in military gear and helicopters makes sense. Writer and organizer Josmar Trujillo talked with us about how media story differs from that of folks on the ground.
There was a great article in a website called the Juvenile Justice Internet Exchange back in 2014 after the West Harlem raids. And it was actually being written before the raids happened. And the headline said it all. It said, "We asked the city for help, we got a raid instead." And what people were saying, and what that author and a lot of people had been saying for a long time, is that to the extent that there was violence, community members wanted to steer youth away from violence to begin with, give them other options in a place where there's virtually no job opportunities, education is crumbling or non-existent. There is a sense amongst a lot of people of color in low-income communities across the city that this just condensation of poverty is at the root of any violence. And again, the violence is being hyped. But to the extent that there is violence, community members wanted an approach that really steered people away and got at root causes, and they were continually ignored over and over. And so what they got instead from the city was a giant raid, because that's what the city understands. That's what the police department understands. And politically, for their own reasons, it was self-serving. They want to show that they're, you know, tough on crime still, you know, even if the crime is a fraction of what it was 20 years ago. I mean, so they placed these kids on a basically like a super predator pedestal and frame them in this way. And all of those conversations about after-school programming, community centers that need to be reopened because they've been closed for 5 years. In Manhattanville, which is one of the houses in West Harlem, they had a community center closed for 5 years straight. All of those issues just are completely ignored. Poverty, we don't want to hear it. Opportunities, what's that? Like, it's about the gang raid. It's about the gang member this, gang member that. And that's all it ends up being for the people who hear about this in the media, and that's all they'll ever see about it. That's the double slap in the face. On the one side, you get the raid, and on the other side, you get the media painting your entire life as just revolving around violence.
As killings by police of black people continued, so too did the monitoring and videotaping of police by citizens, often the critical factor in shedding light on the crisis. Shahid Buttar discussed the importance of that witnessing.
The First Amendment unambiguously protects the right to observe and record police activities. And the failure of police departments and agents and officers around the country to respect those rights, and similarly the failure of the journalistic profession, I think, generally to stand in solidarity with those rights, that is to say, the right of the press, which does not make a distinction between professional and grassroots journalists, is alarming. And I think this is one of the places where the rubber hits the road in terms of the words in the Constitution and the rights they aim to protect, that being the rubber hitting the road of social practice, and in this case is public safety agencies that perceive any threat to their own political power as analogous to a threat to public safety. And that exactly, of course, is precisely gets the relationship wrong, because the people who are capturing police violence on video, they are the ones enhancing public safety here, as well as standing behind very well-settled law that unfortunately the agencies and unfortunately a lot of journalists choose to disregard. I mean, the journalistic profession has been taking it on the chin at the hands of the government for decades. And, you know, to watch the ranks of journalists sort of fail to internalize that attack is disappointing. I mean, I go back to the Justice Department monitoring the cell phones of AP journalists in Washington, right? Or the repeated attempts to force reporters to divulge their sources in the context of investigations of national security leaks, or for that matter, the vilification of whistleblowers, which is no different. I mean, across all of these contexts, what we are talking about is criminalizing transparency to protect illegitimate uses of power. And that, of course, is what the Constitution is supposed to stop.
Before Trump, there was Brexit, a referendum on Britain leaving the EU. Another campaign marked by nativism and racism. We talked with Joe McAray, publisher of Truthout, about that.
The mainstream parties have been very willing to use xenophobic, anti-immigrant rhetoric to one degree or another to ensure that they win votes, and also as a way of redirecting resentment as their economic policies have caused poverty and have created a huge amount of resentment amongst working people in the UK. They need to redirect that resentment to someone. And as always, an obvious target is people who are new to the country. And it's a combination of the kind of Islamophobia we see in the US as well, but also often specifically xenophobia against economic immigrants from elsewhere in Europe, where what's happening is basically a kind of narrowing of the definition of whiteness again to mean that like Polish people living in the UK are suddenly considered other and unacceptable. So I think that like you have to look at how those mainstream parties and the media have really done a huge amount of work in making the kind of racism that demonstrated by those far-right parties acceptable. Obvious parallels to someone like Donald Trump in the sense that the media play a huge role in legitimizing and giving a platform to and creating the fame of someone, and then retroactively claim, well, we have to cover this person, we have to give him a platform because he's popular.
Right.
And also that a lot of this media purports to be in some way left-leaning or liberal and will then very regretfully say, well, this is terrible, but has in fact legitimized this. And you see it in some of the things that were kind of op-eds that nominally left papers like The Guardian or nominally liberal papers like The Independent have been willing to publish op-eds by people basically saying, well, you know, we need to have a conversation about Muslims living in the UK, or we need to have a conversation about the number of economic migrants. And what that basically doing is making forms of racism and xenophobia into a sort of legitimate voice in a debate.
Many Americans are still in shock about the election of Donald Trump, but there is work to be done. We talked about looking forward on the global front with Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies.
Dealing with here is a situation where he talks about his great slogan, making America great again, and the foreign policy and military part of making America great seems to be going back to an era of what he would consider unchallenged U.S. global hegemony. So it's less about creating a foreign policy that works, that protects people in the U.S. and makes us a good partner internationally. It's less about that than about a foreign policy that will ensure that the U.S. does not have a serious challenger. So I think what we're dealing with is a great deal of uncertainty. The only thing that we know for sure is that social movements are going to be far more important than anyone else. Social movements are going to be more important than who's in the Congress, who's in the White House, who's in the Supreme Court, because that's the only way we're going to have to change history. I think one of the things that we've seen very dangerous in the election process and in the coming Trump presidency is that the movement that rose up around his campaign has within it a really almost fascist core of racism, misogyny, xenophobia, Islamophobia. And this is very dangerous if that movement begins to feel that with Trump in the White House, they somehow have power and impunity from accountability, that they have legitimacy that they should never have had and never deserved. It will be even more dangerous. And so our social movements, I think many of us were already preparing for resisting what we anticipated would be a Clinton administration, saying no honeymoon, no waiting, mobilize immediately a movement against wars and escalation. We're still going to have to do that, but now we're going to have to do that, I think, in the context of a broader resistance movement where motions to work to build movements against wars is going to have to also be movements to defend refugees that are trying to come here as a result of those wars. And it's also going to have to link with movements who are providing the first defense for endangered communities, whether those be immigrant communities, refugees, people of color, Muslim communities, Arabs, women, LGBTQ communities. All of these communities could face serious dangers in the coming period because of that movement that has risen through the campaign process. And our movements to stop wars and create a foreign policy based on diplomacy over war is going to have to be part of those broader movements aimed at protecting those most vulnerable communities.
If 2016 shone a severe light on problems that have long been with us, it also helpfully highlighted some of the people who have been working on those problems all the while, without the headlines, without the attention, and on the irreplaceable work of organizing. The fight, led by indigenous women over the Dakota Access Pipeline, showcased corporate media's interests. They couldn't even be bothered to defend journalists arrested for reporting the story, and also showed what solidarity in defense of the planet and of one another can look like. That story's not over. We spoke with writer, organizer, and photographer Kelly Hayes
about what happens now.
That's the problem for us, right, is that Donald Trump is about to take office, and he's already stated that the moment he's in office, all of this gets reevaluated. And we have heard from experts that it would be a matter of hours if Trump were determined to do so for him to dismantle these gains that we have recently made. So it's important for us always to find joy and to celebrate each other and to celebrate how far we've come and to celebrate the losses of our opponents. But we are at a very critical time, and mischaracterizing this as the larger battle being won risks us falling from the headlines, risks this entire story being pushed out of public view. It took a whole lot of fighting. It took a whole lot of people getting hurt and really living this struggle in order for this to be seen. So we're at a critical juncture in terms of making sure that this does not become unseen, that it does not lose the attention that it's gained. And we're also at a critical juncture in terms of where we direct our resistance now. The truth is they are more vulnerable now than they have ever been in terms of money getting shut off. We have one bank that's already disinvested. We have Wells Fargo sending out letters to people who have objected, saying that they're willing to sit down with our elders and our leaders. We have millions of dollars that have been moved already through Move Your Money campaigns to get people to divest from banks that are supporting the pipeline. We need to hit on that front harder than ever. We need people to disrupt their banks. We need people to shut down banks that are funding this pipeline. We need people to move their money and make sure that their financial institutions know exactly why they're moving their money. This is where we have the most power now, and that's actually a really beautiful thing because people can do this from wherever they are. Like, we don't need to be able to get to Standing Rock in order to be a part of the front line, you know, as we think about it, because we can create front lines in cities around the country. There is a front line waiting to be created outside of every Wells Fargo, outside of every Chase Bank, and we can all be doing this, but we need to see this as a moment of expansion in this struggle and not a moment of resolution.
That's it for the Best of Counterspin for 2016. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the Media Watch Group based in New York. You can find all of our shows on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. As always, we thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
With Alex Smith knocked out by a vicious flu and the American government falling to a coup of billionaires, we told you so. In this program, The Trouble with Billionaires, a replay from Radio EcoShock, November 12, 2010.
Top banks here are expected to dole out $36 billion in bonuses this year. That's a 20% increase from 2005. Top of the list, Goldman Sachs, with quarterly profits up 93%. The company will distribute a record high $16.5 billion in compensation.
I'd say have your children grow up to be investment bankers.
You can't refinance your home in the blink of an eye, but if you fall behind and you just can't pay, the bank is gonna take your home away, cause they're predators, predators. They keep devouring more and more. They're predators, predators. They're getting richer by preying on the poor.
So the people who get to use the money first, which is created by the Federal Reserve System, benefit. So the money gravitates to the banks and to Wall Street. So that's why you have more billionaires than ever before.
You know, when you really get down to it, one of the things we've really seen in the last 10 years is simply a huge swindle.
And while they celebrated, their world was beginning to fall apart.
Hello, I'm Alex. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I've got two tasty speeches for you on why billionaires are taking over and what we can do about it. A quick note about this week's program. More than half of Radio EcoShock listeners are American, although we have people grabbing the podcast from all over the English-speaking world and beyond. Hello, Britain. Hello, Australia and Switzerland and all of the other countries. Our topic this week, a new book, The Trouble with Billionaires, Why Too Much Money at the Top is Bad for Everyone. You'll hear directly from the authors, tax professor Neil Brooks and journalist Linda McQuaig. Some of the following speech is about Canada, but wait. Most of the examples of billionaires and studies of what people really want are American. You'll hear plenty about Wall Street, the greedy hedge funders, and why Bill Gates doesn't deserve his billions. That is because many developed nations suffer the same disease. A collection of billionaires have taken over the financial system, the political system, and social discourse via the mainstream media, which they also happen to own. As we'll hear, it's an unannounced coup. Welcome to the plutocracy, where democracy used to be. You'll also hear how other countries, like Sweden, deal with the same problems much better to create a fair society. Horrors! The event at the Vancouver Public Library, November 2nd, 2010, was sponsored by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. This recording is by me, Alex Smith, of Radio EcoShock. Here is Neil Brooks, for 35 years a professor of tax law at the University of Toronto and co-author of the book, The Trouble with Billionaires. We tune in partway as Neil outlines the seven premises of the new book.
Here's the seven premises that underlie the book. And incidentally, if you accept these premises, then you have to accept our conclusion. So what I'm going to do is just go through each one, and you can think about whether you agree or disagree with the premises. Here's the first premise of the book. If this is really what motivated the book, we feel that the increasing inequality in income over the past 30 years in Canada, and particularly the increasing amount of national income that is being captured by the very, very rich, the top 1%, is the most profound change in our society in our lifetimes. And indeed, that growing gap between the ultra-rich and everyone else will continue, it is now, and will continue to reshape virtually every aspect of our society to the great detriment of ordinary Canadians. It diminishes the well-being of us all, it tears at the fabric of our society, and it corrupts our democracy. And so basically, the rise of this upper rich class is enabling them to rewrite the terms of the social contract that served Canadians and Americans so well in that post-war period in the 40s, 50s, and the 1960s. They're in effect rewriting that contract in a way that in effect means that from now on the general social institutions will largely favor their interests. So we wrote the book because we're concerned that the kind of society we're becoming, namely a plutocracy in which the rich have a vastly disproportionate influence over public policies and are, in effect, legislating largely in their own self-interest and, as I say, to the detriment, it seems to us, of ordinary Canadians. So that's really what motivated the book, our concern about this rising ultra-rich class. And basically our argument is that equality matters. And some people say we should only be concerned about inequality at the lower end of the income scale. We should only be concerned about bringing people up out of the poverty level. That's just wrong. A small number of very rich people are as great an obstacle to a flourishing society as a large number of poor people. And we take seriously the well-known words of the famous English social critic, Richard Taney, who said, "What thoughtful rich people call the problem of poverty, thoughtful poor people with equal justice call the problem of riches." Indeed, it's no coincidence that those countries that have the highest rates of poverty are also those countries with the highest degree of inequality at the high end of the income scale. The United States, for example, has by far the most billionaires in the world, and yet in the United States they have the highest rate of poverty of any industrialized country. Indeed, in the United States, over 20% of children live in families below the poverty line. There's just a basic immorality about that. But the point is, the fight against poverty can't be divorced from the underlying inequalities. So that's the first premise, that inequality matters, and it is, of course, an empirical, sociological premise, but it seems to me it would be hard to disagree with. The second premise is that over the last 30 years, while the percentage of families below the poverty line has remained stubbornly high, the wages of workers have stagnated, the rich have been getting much, much richer at everyone else's expense. And this is the case not only in Canada and the United States, but all Anglo-American countries. And the evidence of inequality at the top end is just everywhere. Most obviously, it's evidenced by the astronomical amounts paid to athletes and entertainers, hedge fund managers, investment specialists, chief executive officers, software entrepreneurs, and top earners in the professions like law and medicine. Most of those markets have become what we call winner-take-all markets, in which small numbers of people are making huge amounts. As I mentioned, the income in Canada of the median family, that is, if you just take the family that earns the amount of income right in the middle of the income distribution of income, so 50% people make more, families make more, 50% less. If you take the median family, the income of the median family in Canada has not gone up in real terms in 30 years. Back in 1975, in 2008 dollars, the median family was making about $45,000. That's about what they're making now. It's just stagnated over that whole period of time. But in the meantime, the income of high-income people has simply skyrocketed. In terms of billionaires, for example, from 1999 to 2009, the number of billionaires in Canada has more than doubled, from 25 to 55. Back in the 1960s, CEOs made about 20 times as much as the average worker. Now they make at least 200 times. That means, of course, that the average worker would have to work 200 years just to make the same amount as a CEO makes in 1 year. If someone is only earning minimum wages, they have to work 750 years to make the amount that a CEO makes in 1 year. Indeed, on average, the 10, if you just take the 10 top-paid CEOs, they make more than 900 times the average worker, which means someone working the minimum wage would have to work 2,483 years simply to make the same amount as those folks make in 1 year. Indeed, those folks make, the salaries they're drawing, they make on about $16,000 an hour, which means if they were here tonight at the end of this little talk, they'd have earned enough to go on a first-class trip all over the world, stopping at all the major cities, whereas most of us at the end of this talk, we were lucky if we can go home. Afford to go buy a beer and an aspirin or something. The differences are just huge, beyond imagination. And furthermore, of course, most of them are incompetent. Speaking of CEOs, I mean, and it turns out dishonest as well. I mean, I understand. I might forgive them for being incompetent. We're all a little incompetent, but it does seem to me to be pushing the envelope when you're both incompetent and dishonest. But the studies that we relied on, incidentally, primarily, and sort of talking about this increasing inequality, and I'm just going to take a minute to explain this because this is sort of so fundamental to both what motivated our book and also our recommendations and just our understanding of what's happening in our world, is that over the last 10 years, there's been a bunch of public finance economists in a number of different countries that have been looking, using income tax data, using statistics from income tax. And in Canada, our income tax was passed back in 1917. And so they're collecting all that statistics from people who file tax returns from 1917 on and are making estimates about, you know, what share of the national income is going to the top 1%, of course, or the top 0.1%. And so they've been conducting this over the last 10 years. And you'll see their studies referred to a lot in the book in most of the Anglo-American countries. And what they have found is that over the course of the 20th century in Anglo-American countries, that the degree of income inequality, again, we're talking here about that at the top end, can be divided into four distinct periods. First of all is at the turn of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century is what we often refer to as the Gilded Age, where there was this upper-class opulence and ostentatious displays of wealth, and everyone spoke of robber barons, and everyone understood the rich were ripping everyone else off. And in Canada during that period, say in the late 1920s, the top 1% were getting around 15 or 16% of the total income. 15 or 16% of the total income being earned in Canada went to people in the top 1%. And it's important to note that those families could accumulate that vast wealth at the time because there basically wasn't a progressive tax system. And there wasn't any wealth tax that was taxing people when they transferred wealth from one generation to the next. And so they were able to accumulate these vast fortunes. And then the second period is often referred to as the period of the Great Compression. It basically started the beginning of the 1930s until the end of World War II. And during that period, the share of national income going to the top 1% dropped dramatically. It went from about 15% down to 10%, about 10%. And partly, I mean, because of financial shocks and the war and so on, but also that we introduced really progressive taxes during that period. Indeed, during World War II, the top income tax rate on people earning what would be now over $3.5 million a year was 90%, you know. Those are what people like me refer to as the good old days. We had a serious tax system for people earning lots of money. And we introduced a wealth tax so that when rich people went to transfer their wealth from one generation to the next, the state took 50% of it. Indeed, those rates went up to 70% on wealth over a certain period. So there was this dramatic drop in it. Then, and here's the interesting part, then from 1945 right up until the end of the 1970s, the amount of national income going to the top 1% continued to decline. At the end of World War II, it was about 10%. By the end of the 1970s, it was about 70%. Throughout that whole period, we continued to become a more equal society. And let me just make two points about that. One point is, there isn't any question, and I think all economic historians agree with this, is that that continuing equality was brought about largely by government policy. Among other things, throughout that whole period, the top income tax rate in Canada was 80%. Again, it only applied to very rich people. People are earning over a million or so, but at 80%, it varied slightly, but around 80% throughout that whole, we had a wealth tax, so that wealthy families who tried to pass all of their wealth from one generation to the next paid a wealth tax. So it was largely government policy that was explaining that increasing equality. Secondly, that during this period, as our society was becoming more equal, I'm sure as you all know, we had our highest rates of economic growth we've ever had, lowest rates of unemployment. That is, there was just broad shared prosperity throughout that whole period. And indeed, in the 1960s, when I went to university and was growing up, people, the average person's standard of living was doubling every 17 years. Everyone could see they were going to be better off than their parents. And so it was a period of just sort of broad optimism, shared prosperity, and basically our society was becoming more equal. Then what happened, and I'm sure you all are familiar with this story, is beginning in the 1980s, and this is what we call now the Great Divergence, beginning in the 1980s, the social contract that had guided Canada throughout that 30 years of shared prosperity began to unravel. And business interests, concerned that they were losing their privileged position in society, literally went on attack. They just launched a vicious, systematic, and comprehensive attack against the welfare state and began implementing what we widely refer to as the corporate agenda. Economic growth slowed, unemployment increased, but the rich began regaining their privileged position. Indeed, their share of income that they held during the Gilded Age. So by 2007, the top 1% were in effect now receiving over 14% of national income. That is, the amount of national income going to the top 1% literally doubled from 1980 to 2007. And the share going to the really rich, the top 0.01%, tripled over that period. The top 0.01% were getting about 1% of national income in 1980. They were getting almost 3% in 2007. And during that rate, income tax rates, of course, were going down. They went down from 70 to 60 to 50, and now in many provinces, somewhere between 40 and 45 is the top rate. And it kicks in at a very low income level. If you're earning $130,000 in most provinces, you're in the top income tax bracket. You pay the same marginal tax rate whether you're earning $130,000 or whether you're earning a million. So that our progressive tax system was just decimated. So that's the second premise, anyway, that over the past 30 years, this has been dramatic and unprecedented increase in inequality in the distribution of income and wealth. And no one disputes that, well, except the people in the Financial Post. In fact, Linda and I got in a little exchange with a couple of the reporters from the National Post. They denied that there was increasing. But generally, no one in the reality-based community disputes those numbers. In fact, Linda wondered, what are they going to dispute next, global warming? The third premise is that, so you got to agree, the first two aren't, equality matters, and we've had this dramatic increase in inequality at the high end. Here's the third premise. The causes of that increased inequality, some people say, well, the effect of all that income going to the rich, the top 1%, is just, it's an inevitable result of the way the world is changing. It's just a result of technological changes. It's the result of globalization. It's the result of the increased premium that skilled workers are able to demand. But we argue that's just wrong in the book. In fact, we argue instead it's the result of a long series of deliberate policy changes in government, policies that overwhelmingly favored the very rich. And those changes, in turn, were the result of increasingly sophisticated, well-financed, well-organized efforts by the corporate and financial sectors to, in effect, tilt government policies in their favor and thus favor the very wealthy. And those changes, including the deregulation of the financial industry, changes in corporate governance policies that allowed CEOs to basically set their own pay, changes in industrial relations policies that weakened labor unions, and most importantly, changes in the tax system that dramatically changed the wealthy. In short, inequality has nothing to do with the dictates of the market economy. It's the result of people at the top rigging the rules to their benefit. And they got government to stack the deck in their favor and then hire people like those working for the Fraser Institutes to try to tell other people it's just the natural working of the marketplace. In the book, we explain inequality as a function of power sustained by politics and implemented as policy. That's our third. The fourth premise is that the wealth and income of the rich is simply undeserved. I mean, they might argue, yeah, it's true. There's all this wealth going to wealthy people, but they deserve it. We argue there's no moral theory that would justify the vast incomes they receive. Indeed, given the enormous advantages and freedoms that income and wealth provides, this skewed distribution of income presents Canada with its most pressing, or one of its most pressing, moral issues. Those opposed to the use of progressive taxes often argue, as an instrument for redistributing income, argue that there's something inherently fair and just about the market distribution of income. That is, they start with the assumption that those top income people somehow deserve their good fortune. And they usually state that position rhetorically something like, it's my income, I earned it in a free market, the government has no right to take and redistribute it to others. There's two things that invalidate that position. One is, it's just conceptually incoherent. And there's no such thing as a free market. And the second one, even if it were conceptually coherent, it does not rest on a persuasive or any theory of distributive justice. First, it's conceptually incoherent since there's simply no such thing as a free market. And the rules of property contract and property law and contract law within which individuals earn their income, in fact, are as coercive as politically motivated and have even greater distributional consequences than the tax system. We lawyers call this the baseline problem. That is, there's just a whole bunch of laws out there. All of them are the result of political decisions. And so you can't sort of say, well, we're going to look at these laws and regard this as being our baseline as to what people are entitled to. And then any laws after that are taking away something they're entitled to. They're all laws that govern our interaction with one another, property laws, contract laws, all have distributional consequences, all are politically motivated. And so that it's just incoherent to try to argue that somehow people have entitlement to income they earn before the application of the tax system. I mean, what you're entitled to is what you've got after the application of all of those laws, including the tax system. There is actually a very nice section in the book on this, if I may say so, that I think makes this point sort of clearer than I've seen it made before, and it's just a profound point. But it has to do with, for example, a real simple example, like lawyers. We restrict admission to law schools, we give them monopoly over the practice of law, we don't allow, you know, immigrants to come in and join the law society and compete with them. We give them all this monopoly protection over the practice of law, which means that the practice of law tends to be much more lucrative than it otherwise would be. There's no question, as a result of all those regulations, lawyers make a lot more money than they would if we just let it rip. Again, there might be good reasons for those laws. We're protecting consumers of legal services and so on. But it's odd to argue that somehow that gives them a moral entitlement to that income. And that somehow then when you impose a tax on them, you're taking something, you're redistributing. I mean, we redistribute it up, you know, through all these regulations. And so all we're now trying to do is achieve a distribution of income that we think is morally acceptable through the tax system. We have this wonderful example in the book from Michael Caine in England. England, you might know, raised their top income tax rate from 40 to 50, and Michael Caine said he's going to leave England if they do that. He, you know, he's got all this hard-earned income that he makes as a movie star. He's going to leave England if they try to take his hard-earned income away from him. We point out he only got that income because of government regulations. He only got that income because we got copyright laws. That means when he makes a movie, other people got to pay to view it. And so he only got it because of government regulations, and we point out that if it wasn't for the copyright laws, he'd probably be making as much as any good porn movie actor would. Because in the porn business, you know, they don't enforce the copyright laws. And so some porn people, the people tell me, make a decent living, but none of them are millionaires, or, you know, none of them as much as Michael Caine makes. So he only makes that money because of government regulations. You've got a little chapter called The Porn Industry is the Only Real Free Market. And so some people say, well, yeah, but, you know, but if you didn't give them copyright protection, there wouldn't be innovation in movies and so on. I don't know about that. But people do tell me that in the porn industry, there's lots of innovation and lots of... But the whole point is just that there's a whole body of rules and protections that account for people's income, and it's odd to say, oh, yeah, but as a result of those, I have some entitlement you're taking away. We argue also in the book that generally these people don't deserve the income they receive because most of it is just due to luck. The accident of being born into a wealthy family, the accident of being born into a wealthy country. Pure accident. I mean, the one thing you've got no control over is who your parents are. And yet we know that has just a dramatic effect on how much income you will eventually earn. Just a dramatic effect. The good luck of investing in the right stock, the good luck of remaining able. So we argue that, you know, that these people, they're just, you know, they're lucky. Like they flip the coin 10 times and think they're clever. I mean, like if 1,000, no, here's the point I was going to make. If 1,000 people flipped a coin, right, flipping a coin, I think 3 of them would flip 10 heads in a row. But just pure, absolutely pure luck, right? But some of these fancy billionaires who flip 10 think it's due to their intelligence or hard work. It's just pure luck. Here, the fifth premise, now I'll go through 1 minute on each one of these. The fifth one is this. They don't deserve it. Furthermore, the amount of income that they get is like having that relatively small number of rich people in a society is not a benign characteristic of a society. It greatly diminishes the quality of life of everyone else in the society. And we cite all sorts of studies that show that having that small group of very rich people up there leads to a reduction in social mobility. Indeed, if you're interested in social mobility, you have to be interested. Some people say, well, let's not worry about how much the rich are getting because people can sort of move up and down the income scale and we've got lots of social mobility. In fact, the evidence is that if you've got a high degree of inequality at the top end, it reduces social mobility in the society. Indeed, the United States, which has about the highest degree of inequality among the industrialized countries, also has the lowest degree of social mobility. Indeed, if you were in the United States today and you were interested in pursuing the American dream, my advice to you would be, you know, move to Norway. You will not get it in the States. Much more social mobility in equal countries. Unequal societies have a great increase in criminal violence and other forms of social disorder, reduced physical and mental health, reduced life expectancy, just a long litany of problems that are caused by this enormous inequality. We also, of course, contribute the financial crises to the inequality. Most importantly is just that it diminishes our democracy. And in the book, we go through all the subtle processes by which wealthy individuals are able to exert undue influence on public policy decision-making. The sixth premise is that the pursuit of a more equal society is not inconsistent with high levels of economic well-being. Lots of reasons for supporting that provided in the book. A quick answer, just look around the world. You will discover those societies which are most equal, like the Nordic countries, also tend to be the most economically competitive. Look at the historical evidence. You find that in those periods of Canadian history, when we had the greatest degree of equality, we also had the fastest rates of economic growth, lowest rates of unemployment. We provide... And then finally, what we argue in the book, the last premise is that if we really want to do something to reduce the inequality in our society, particularly the amount of national income going to... But you've got to use the tax system. And we make an argument as to why the tax system is the most effective policy instrument. Among other things, you can target it at the top 1% very easily through progressive income taxes and wealth taxes. It's much more, it can be effective immediately. Some people say, oh, well, let's just improve our educational system. Well, come and see me in 40 years. Maybe we can improve it. We'll make a difference. But by then it'll be too late. So we say, look, we should operate on all fronts to remove inequality, but the tax system is essential. So in conclusion, the argument in the book is not about bashing the rich simply because they're rich. It's about deciding in what kind of a society Canadians aspire to live in. And the social contract we think that most Canadians are in favor of is one that is premised on the assumption that each of us is born with an equal moral worth and entitlement to dignity and to the rights of citizenship, that choices individuals make as citizens participating and voting in democracies, democratic procedures are as important as the choices we make as consumers, that our greatest achievements as a society are the product not of individual endeavor, but of community and collective efforts, that freedom involves the power to make choices about how one lives, that most people are essentially alike, with minor differences that are often interesting, that all Canadians, rich or poor, have a shared destiny, that we're all in the same boat together, and that the quality of our lives should not be measured by the lifestyles of the rich, but by the legitimate aspirations of every individual. And that is both just and feasible, that everyone is entitled to a fair share of what we collectively produce, but only a fair share. Now, those who oppose our proposals we make in the book will likely say that lower taxes on the rich is not a matter of political choice, but an economic imperative. That's profoundly wrong. It's contradicted by theory, by empirical evidence, but most importantly, simply by our experience and our common sense. Canadians still do have a good deal of choice in deciding what kind of society that they want to live in, and choosing that society remains a political and deeply moral issue. Lately, the business interest has lamented the terrible legacy we're leaving in our children in the form of a national debt. In fact, the much worse legacy we are in danger of leaving them if we continue to allow the corporate agenda to be implemented, if we continue to diminish the progressivity of our tax system and the role of government in our lives, is a society in which resources are distributed in an obscenely unequal way, a society in which the relevant standard of living of the average family continues to stagnate, a society without a sense of itself or a sense of its collective responsibility, and a society in which the economic elite is ever more able to defend itself politically. That, the book argues, would be a truly unjust, a truly irresponsible legacy for us to leave to the next generation. Hopefully someday, because of books like this and work being done by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives and other resources, Canadians will once again demand that their political parties have enough heart, have enough intelligence, and have enough courage to stand up and openly confront the power of the plutocracy. Thank you very much.
You have just heard Professor Neil Brooks speaking at the Vancouver Public Library on November 3, 2010, about his new co-author book, The Trouble with Billionaires, Why Too Much Money at the Top is Bad for Everyone. Next up, best-selling author and business columnist and co-author Linda McQuaig.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to A Blast from the Past, The Trouble with Billionaires, as broadcast on Radio EcoShock. In 2010, well before billionaires replaced the former politicians of the United States.
Should society be more equal, more fair in the distribution of wealth created by a whole civilization in which we and all our ancestors have built? Or should billionaires run the whole show? This week on Radio EcoShock, we hear from two authors of the new book, The Trouble with Billionaires, Why Too Much Money at the Top is Bad for Everyone. Our next speaker is co-author Linda McQuigg. She's a longtime business columnist, author of a string of Canadian bestsellers, and social critic. She questions why Bill Gates or any billionaire should have money worth many times the life work of the average person, and why have the rich taken over since the 1980s? We'll cut in as McQuigg talks about the former media baron and now jailhouse resident Conrad Black, who once suggested Linda should be, quote, horsewhipped. Black later hired McQuigg as a financial journalist at his newspaper, The Financial Post.
Now, I think you're probably expecting I'm going to go on and say some nasty things about Conrad Black, you know. And I have done that at various points in my life, but actually tonight I want to say something nice about Conrad Black. Yeah, you know, it's absolutely true that he has spent his whole life fighting against social justice, but I think he gives us hope. Because he's living proof that even a rich right-wing jerk can end up in jail, and that shows social justice is possible. I should point out, there are other books out there about the rise of the new rich, but they're a little bit different. They're often sort of all about how glamorous and exciting the lives of the rich are. And amazingly, you know, even in the wake of the financial crisis in 2008, we're still getting that kind of book. You know, there's a new book out about John Paulson. You know, he's that hedge fund manager who made $3.7 billion betting against the subprime mortgage market, you know, giving him the all-time record in history for profiting from the misery of others. Because really, his bet, his trade, as they call it, helped trigger the financial crisis with all the, of course, horrible repercussions that we're all still experiencing from that. Now, you might expect a journalist writing a book about this guy would have some critical things to say. But surprisingly, this book is extremely positive. He's portrayed as a hero. You get a sense from the title. It's written by a Wall Street Journal reporter, and the title of it is The Greatest Trade Ever. But, you know, that may be the view on Wall Street and on Bay Street and places like that. But our sense is that among ordinary people, the view is probably closer to those protesters who marched down Wall Street carrying a placard saying, "Jump, you fuckers." So I guess I just want to clarify that, you know, our book is more in the kind of "jump, you fuckers" genre of books about the rich. The extreme level of inequality that we see today, this incredible rise of income at the top, while the rest of the population has really been stagnant, I think that Canadians, by and large, don't really know that story. You know, essentially what's happened is all the income growth in the last 3 decades has gone to the top. It's gone to the top 10%, but it's particularly gone to the top 1%. And the higher up within that 1% you go, the bigger the economic gains are. So, for instance, 30 years ago, the average CEO typically had an income that was 20 to 30 times the average wage. Today, that gap is that the average CEO has an income that's roughly 200 to 300 times the average wage. The top hedge fund managers in the financial business, you know, the gap is even more extreme. For instance, here's one statistic that always stuns me. In 2009, like that's after the financial crash, the top 25 hedge fund managers earned on average, $1 billion each. Okay? And that, by the way, is not 200 or 300 times the average wage, that is 24,000 times the average wage. And by the way, some of these numbers are American. The case has been most extreme in the United States, but it has been very much the case here in Canada as well. In the last dozen years in Canada, for instance, while the incomes of ordinary people have been stagnant, and you may not feel that the incomes are stagnant, but you well, you probably do feel that they're stagnant. But in case you're doubting that, don't forget that people in the middle class are basically working twice as hard as they did earlier because, of course, they have two incomes, whereas 30 years ago it was not unusual to have a single family income or one income for a family. Anyway, while this has basically been stagnant among ordinary people, in Canada in the past dozen years, the incomes of the top 50 CEOs have risen on average by 440%. Just a staggering increase at the top. And our sense, and I'm sure you got this clearly from Neil, is our sense is this is just a dramatic change. This is a dramatic change that cries out for some kind of justification. You know, you fundamentally change how money is distributed among the people in society, and nobody kind of even comments on it. And you raise it and you're considered some kind of weird radical or something. We think it absolutely cries out for justification. Now, to the extent that there is a justification out there in the business press, it tends to be that the people at the top have to have these big incentives, right? They have to have the incentives so they will perform to optimal capacity, that this is really necessary for the success of our economy. So you would think, given the huge rewards at the top, that the performance must be just staggering. I think you know where I'm going with this. Let's just give you a couple of quick, fun examples. That in 2009, after the terrible financial crash, the head of Merrill Lynch gave their top executives $4 billion worth of bonuses. This is right after this top team had just steered the company to $29 billion in losses. And I think some reporter asked him, you know, why are you doing this? And he said, well, we have to do this to keep our most talented people. Which makes you wonder what some of the less talented people they had might have done. But our point is that when you look through the evidence, there's just simply no evidence of a justification for this enormous run-up at the top. Today's top earners are not more talented, they're not more creative, they're not more hardworking than the top earners were 30 years ago. They're not worth 200 or 300 times what the average income person is working. They're certainly not worth 24,000 times what the average worker is earning. In fact, we argue that there's no justification. What basically has happened is there's been simply a kind of a coup that, in effect, what's happened is, you know, this concentration of income at the top, this huge income, is the result of a, you know, massive, masterful political campaign to get more for themselves. And how did they do it? Well, you know what? I'm going to throw in a list here. Okay? Well, I'm just going to quickly say that, Neil, four items I want to draw your attention to. Basically, this is our point, that it's not something haphazard. It's a deliberate campaign. And we identify, for instance, changes in CEO compensation, stock options principally, very, very key factor in driving up wages. Changes in ideology, the ideology of neoliberalism that basically encouraged the encouragement of greed and accumulation at the top and the kind of tolerance for greed in society, which was not the case 30 years ago. Changes, very crucial changes in the tax system that drove taxes down for people at the upper end. And also, fourthly, the changes that have disempowered labor, because by disempowering labor, that is empowered capital and has allowed capital to basically trample on the rights of so many working people. And so what we argue basically is that this enormous concentration of wealth at the top, it's kind of a scam really what's happened. And partly the reason it's a scam is because they haven't been honest. You know, the group at the top that have orchestrated this big change, it's not as if they came out and said, well, you know, we're greedy. We would like more. They don't say that. Instead, They couch it in terms of it's an economic necessity. You have to do this. You have to cut taxes on the rich. If you don't cut taxes on the rich, you will destroy the economic performance of your country. You'll gut economic growth. You'll limit economic growth. And therefore, in the interest of all of us, we have to cut taxes on the rich. That's the way they sold it to us. Well, as Neil has pointed out, next time somebody makes that argument to you, one of the things you can say is, well, after you say, go flames, go, you know, then the next thing you say is that, in fact, high taxes, there's no evidence that high taxes actually do anything to destroy economic growth. Because, in fact, if you look at that post-war period, 1945 to 1980, the taxes on the rich, as Neil's mentioned, were incredibly high. The marginal tax rates were 80 and 90%, both in Canada and the United States. And yet both in Canada and the United States, those were the periods of greatest economic growth in our countries. They were vibrant capitalist economies. So you cannot argue that the high taxes destroyed economic growth. It is simply refuted by the evidence. And in fact, strikingly, since the taxes have been reduced since 1980, and they have been dramatically reduced since 1980. You know, we mentioned there was marginal tax rates as high as 80 and 90 to, in fact, above 90% some years. They're now down to the top marginal tax rate is 46%. Dramatic reduction. And yet, since that's happened, economic growth has slowed down as well. So the lower taxes since 1980 have not produced the big cornucopia that we're always told about. Now, the other big argument, of course, they always come out with is that if you have high tax on the rich, they'll leave, right? They'll leave. Well, you know, I was going to say, when people say that, and your point is, you know. But, you know, this is actually a huge topic, and since Neil talked so long, I don't really have the time to get into it. But let me just say, some will go, they will, and they'll be very noisy when they go. The truth is most won't go because most people actually make decisions in their lives for more reasons than just the rate of tax. You know, they like to live in a country because their family's here, their friends, whatever. We actually have some interesting arguments in the book about how to deal with the problem of tax havens. But and maybe we can talk about that in the question period, but I won't get into that now. But I guess the real point I wanted to make is just simply to raise the point. It's interesting the way we just let them hold us hostage like that. I mean, imagine if another group in society, not the rich, another group, let's say plumbers, you know, or electricians or something, threatened to leave the country unless we did exactly what they wanted. You know, would we immediately kind of submit to them and just do what they wanted? I mean, it just seems a curious kind of approach that we don't think, isn't this odd that we're being demanded to do these things? And if we don't, you know, they're going to threaten to leave, and that we sort of think, well, then we better do it. I have this whole thing I want to talk about why Bill Gates doesn't deserve his fortune, but I think maybe I don't have time. Do I have time? Or, not many Bill Gates fans here tonight. Okay. Well, all right. What I want to say then is that today's concentration of income at the top is a reflection of what we called, or what could be called, the great man theory, right? The idea that, you know, there's certain individuals who are just so talented and so much better than the rest of us that kind of all by themselves they make great things happen. And, you know, if they were to leave the country, we'd barely be able to figure out how to turn the lights on. And this notion is, therefore, you know, that because these people are so talented, they really deserve their billions. And in fact, this kind of theory is often advanced by billionaires. So for instance, here's just a couple of billionaires. Here's Leo Hendry, who invented a sports cable TV network. He said, "I think there are some people, including myself, who are, because of their uniqueness, warrant whatever the market will bear." One of the things I like about billionaires is their modesty. Or here's Sanford Vail, a big Wall Street tycoon. He says, In the last 25 years, the last 25 years is an incredibly unique period. We didn't rely on somebody else to build what we built. We did it ourselves. Really, really, really. That's an interesting thought. So in other words, if Sanford Vale had been abandoned at birth on a desert island, he would have built his fortune up, goddamn, exactly the same way that he did, right? Well, maybe not. And so the interesting thing is that, you know, we would argue that if he could build up that fortune all by himself, abandoned on a desert island, then he should be able to keep every single bit of it because he did it all himself. But if he couldn't reproduce it all on his own, then I think it's reasonable to ask the question, how much did he create and how much did other people create? Because the great man theory always leaves out the role of society, right? It always leaves out the role of every other person in the great man's life. The people that nurtured that person, that educated him, that created the society that allowed him to thrive. And most crucially, what it leaves out is the technological inheritance from the past that enabled his breakthrough to happen. And so here we come to Bill Gates. Now, Bill Gates is credited with inventing the operating system of the personal computer. But that was only possible because of all the advances that had happened before that. In fact, the computer itself had already been invented by the time Bill Gates was born. So every advance that led to the development of the computer and every advance before that, going all the way back to the beginning of, you know, the invention of the wheel, every advance builds on the other. And the truth is, Bill Gates could never, of course, have invented the personal computer if all those advances hadn't come before. So the notion, you know, we didn't really rely on somebody else, we did it all ourselves, it's just ludicrous. Every individual relies on thousands of individuals in society and historically many more tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. In fact, it's been calculated that this technological inheritance is responsible for something like 90% of the wealth that's generated today. It's just an immense inheritance. So the question is, who does that inheritance belong to? Who should be the beneficiary of all that technological development from the past? Well, under our current system, Bill Gates gets virtually all the benefits from the personal computer, even though he only really was involved in the very last stage of the development. Oh, and by the way, here's another kind of cute irony. Bill Gates actually didn't invent the operating device of the personal computer. Actually, it was another guy. It was Gary Kildall. And Bill Gates knew Gary Kildall, but he managed to kind of elbow him out of the way and get the contract with IBM instead. And in fact, that kind of thing is typical, because the way science works is that one advance leads to another. And when a scientific breakthrough happens, the next stage is kind of obvious and more or less inevitable to the relatively small number of people that are working in that field. So with or without Bill Gates, we would have had the personal computer. We would have had it because of the technological inheritance from the past. So the point is, why should $53 billion be in Bill Gates' pocket rather than sharing a larger amount of that through taxation with society at large? And we have in the book a number of ideas about how we can increase the taxes. And, you know, again, when you say this kind of thing, when you talk about increasing taxes on the rich, for instance, we suggest that there should be a new top marginal tax rate for incomes above $500,000. So probably not too many people in the room are going to be affected by that. But there are a number of Canadians making over $500,000 a year. And we think they should, once they reach $500,000, income above that should be taxed at the rate of 60%. And we think that with incomes above $2.5 million, and by the way, there's about 5,000 Canadians making $2.5 million a year, 59,000 making $500,000 a year, We think anything above $2.5 million should be taxed at 70%. Now, maybe that sounds onerous. If we have a choice, if we have to raise taxes on the rich, raise taxes on the rest of the population, or let government services decline because we don't have enough tax revenue, and therefore punish all the bulk of the population that relies on those programs, if we have those three choices, is raising taxes on the rich such an unreasonable one? I do want to quickly tell you one idea that we have for taxes, tax change that I think is really exciting, and I think you will find it exciting too, and that is to introduce an inheritance tax. We don't have an inheritance tax in Canada. We used to. It was quietly canceled in 1972. And we're one of the few countries in the Western world that doesn't have one. Okay, so what we propose is that inheritance is bigger. You could inherit up to $1.5 million and pay no tax at all. So only going to be the top 1% that are affected by this, okay? So think about it. You get to get $1.5 million without paying any tax, which is interesting when you think about it, because when you earn income up to $1.5 million, you pay lots of tax on it, but we're going to give you an exemption on that first $1.5 million, which is unearned income. I mean, it's due to no skill, no talent, no effort on your part, only the skill of choosing the appropriate parents. You know, I mean, Warren Buffett has called this the ovarian lottery. And I think that's a suitable... But anyway, the exciting part of this is that once we get that money from the taxing people, you know, the top 1% inheritances, there will be enough revenue that we'll be able to set up educational trust funds for every Canadian child. So when every child turns 16, they will have $16,000 deposited into an educational trust fund to be used exclusively for education or training of that child. And you know, we just and in addition to what that will do for national productivity, it will simply do wonders for the notion that this is a inclusive community, that we care about people in our community, and that we actually believe in a concept like equality of opportunity. I think I'm going to wrap up here, but I want to leave you with some good news, okay? Because, you know, sometimes this seems a little down to be thinking of how, you know, how much the rich have gotten richer and how bad Neil's career is. But this is some very good news. And that is ordinary people, not even just people in this room, but even ordinary people out there, actually care about equality to a surprising extent. And the evidence I want to point to is there's an interesting study that just came out that was done by a couple of professors at Harvard. And they interviewed thousands, with something like 5,000 typical Americans, randomly selected. Rich, poor, fat, thin, Republican, Democrat, everything. And there's a couple of things. One of the things they found, the issue they were interviewing them about was to do with inequality and distribution of wealth, okay? And the first thing they discovered is that Americans have absolutely no sense of how actually unequal their country is. They just have no sense whatsoever. And as the Harvard guys pointed out in here, even there were some economists that had been randomly selected, and they had no idea whatsoever either. So that's the first thing, that the actual level of inequality is unknown. But here's the really intriguing thing. Then the second part of the study was to determine, well, what would they like? What would Americans like to have as the level of inequality in their society? Like, how would they like the shares of the national income to be distributed among different segments of the population? And they did this in an intriguing way. They drew up sort of three, I guess you could call them pie charts, okay? And they just labeled them pie A, pie B, and pie C. Pie A was, although they didn't know this, the people doing this didn't know, like the Harvard people knew, but the ordinary people didn't know. Pie A represented the actual distribution of wealth in the United States. So very unequal, okay? Pi B represented the actual distribution of wealth in Sweden, okay? Pi C showed total equality. Well, you know what? It turned out 90% of the Americans, randomly selected, rich, poor, fat, thin, everything, selected as their preferred choice of how wealth should be distributed, Pi B, Sweden. Of course, they didn't know it was Sweden. If they'd known it was Sweden, they would have rejected it. It would be socialism, and they wouldn't have had anything to do with it. But that is the reality. 90% actually favored that fair a distribution of income. Now, that's an American study. But if anything, I think Canada would probably even more that way. And I do have a little bit just quickly to say about Canada. You know, there is lots of evidence that Canadians do care deeply about social programs and care about social programs more than tax cuts. Sure, if you ask them, do you want a tax cut? You know, do you want some chocolate? Do you want some ice cream? You know, they say, yeah, I do. But if you force them to choose, if you say, do you want a tax cut or do you want social reinvestment? Do you want your money spent reinvested in health care, education, pensions, etc.? Overwhelmingly, by margins actually above 80%, Canadians will tell you they want social reinvestment. You know, and this is maybe a little surprising because we tend to think, you know, if you just observe what's going on out there, you tend to think from reading the media that everybody out there is suffering from tax rage. You know, it turns out, in fact, very, very few Canadians are actually suffering from tax rage. In fact, I can tell you, it's really just a small group. It's rich, older men. And I actually have some evidence to back this up. I'm not just making that accusation. My evidence is there's a publication that comes out in the National Post from time to time. It's a weird little publication. It's called The Wealthy Boomer, a very strange publication. It consists of just two things, articles about tax rage and ads for Viagra. You know, which leads me to wonder, you know, does tax rage cause erectile dysfunction? Or does erectile dysfunction cause tax rage? But anyway, my point is that the right is impotent. Actually, sadly, that is not true. The right is not impotent. But my real point is neither are we. And the point is that it's time that we actually started standing up and fighting to make this a more equal society. Thank you very much.
Radio EcoShock.
That was The Thorn in the Side of the Wealthy, journalist and author Linda McQuaig. She was speaking at the Vancouver Public Library with tax professor Neil Brooks to announce their new book, The Trouble with Billionaires, Why Too Much Money at the Top is Bad for Everyone. Now you know, and knowing is half the battle.
Its purpose, to defend human freedom against Cobra, a ruthless terrorist organization determined to rule the world.
He never gives up. He'll stay till the
most disgusting and outrageous act of financial terrorism we've seen in decades. And I'm speaking, of course, of the central banks inflating the money supply.
One of the problems we have now in not having a recovery is that all the money is up there at the top. There is not enough money out there in general circulation. And as long as you have that population, you know, the general population without money in their pockets, going to spend and buy things, businesses are not interested in investing. So if nothing more, in order to stimulate economic growth, get the economy moving, we need to redistribute. We can't just have the money concentrated at the top.
The other half is to reclaim our democracy and social justice. My thanks to the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives for organizing this event and allowing me to record it. Find out more about them at policyalternatives.ca.
That was The Trouble with Billionaires, as recorded by Alex Smith at the Public Library in Vancouver in the fall of 2010. Find more in the show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and if his voice returns, so will Alex Smith next week.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
In Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll be featuring audio from a presentation earlier this year at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C., featuring Rahul Saxena of Palestine Legal and Omar Shaker of the Center for Constitutional Rights. They're talking about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, its growth, and its role as a powerful organizational tool, and the current legislative efforts in the U.S. to try and suppress and punish BDS activists and activism. So stay tuned for that. But before we go to our first segment, let me just say thank you to you, our audience across the world, for listening to this podcast and sharing it with your family and friends and communities, activism circles. If you have a moment, it would help us out a lot if you could go to our iTunes page, leave a review, and give us, of course, a 5-star rating. And last but not least, we're still in our fun drive. We're working to bring you even more exclusive content in 2017, but we can only do that with your help. By supporting the Electronic Intifada, you make sure we can publish original, hard-hitting reporting and analysis about Palestine every day and empower those working for justice with sound information and education. So please donate at electronicintifada.net. Also sign up for our email list, and of course, we thank you. And now here's the Electronic Intifada podcast. A senior student at Earlham College in Indiana has been selected as one of just 3 Rhodes Scholars by the Rhodes Trust for its inaugural Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and Palestine program. Hashim Abu Shama, who joins us today on the podcast, grew up in the Palestinian refugee camp of Al-Arub, just north of Hebron in the occupied West Bank, and is headed to Oxford University, along with Diyala Al-Masri and Noor Arafa, who is a researcher and a policy fellow at the Palestinian think tank Ashabaka. In 2015, Hashim became the first ever youth representative of Palestine refugees at the United Nations, and has served as the president of the student government at Earlham, which last year passed a resolution urging the university to divest from corporations that profit from Israel's violations of Palestinian rights. Hashim Abu Shama, it's so good to have you back with us here at the Electronic Intifada.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
So first off, congratulations on your Rhodes Scholarship. You're the 3rd student from Earlham College to ever receive one. And I read that the last Earlham student who won a Rhodes before you was from the class of 1917, which is exactly a century ago. Tell us about what this means to you.
Well, for me, I think, you know, it means reaching a new milestone for students at Earlham. I think it's opening up more opportunities for the student body. But it also means a lot to where I come from, to Palestine and the refugee camp that I grew up in. In addition to being the first from Earlham in 100 years, I'm also one of the first 2 Rhodes Scholars from Palestine in this historic launch of the program in the Middle East. And I think that represents a lot for me and my community. And this is why I insisted that the press release should be sent first to the primary schools in my refugee camp, because I do think that this is representative of a breakthrough, a new ceiling.
And what has the response been from your community back in El Arub, including your teachers?
It's been beautiful. I would start with my mom's words, because I was in El Arub actually when the news came out. And I could hear my mom in the kitchen saying, "I've always heard of Oxford University, but I've never imagined that one of my kids would actually make it there." And I told her that I would take that as a compliment. I think it represents just a big milestone. And I think it stands as a strong political statement from the community and myself to the world that in the alleys of Palestine refugee camps are big dreams that can reach the United Nations and Oxford University.
And what will you be studying at Oxford?
So I'm thinking of pursuing two master's degrees. The first would be an MSc in Global Governance and Diplomacy, and the second would be an MSc in Refugee and Forced Migration Studies.
And talk about your childhood growing up in Arub, which is in the southern occupied West Bank, and what your plans are when you return to Palestine after your time at Oxford.
So, yeah, I grew up in Al Arub. I attended UNRWA primary schools, and then I went to the Palestinian Authority public schools for the high school. And I finished the Tawjihi successfully in 2012 and got 98.8%, which was one of the highest scores in the district.
That's the Palestinian National High School exams.
Exactly, yeah. and those are very competitive, and there's a lot of media coverage when the scores come out. All of the scores are usually announced in the newspapers and the TV channels and radio stations. So it was definitely a big thing. It still is actually the highest score in the history of my high school. So and after that, I was expected, of course, to study either medicine or engineering. A lot of Arab parents would want that. And I was offered a scholarship to study medicine in Poland. And I almost accepted the scholarship because of the financial burdens that my family faces. But then I ended up rejecting the scholarship. I took a gap year, and I wanted to apply to schools in the U.S. to study international relations. So this is what happened. And 4 years after, I'm here now. And so after graduating from Oxford, I'm hoping to get involved in the sector of community building. And growing up in Arub and being exposed to the Palestinian curriculum, I think the curriculum has a lack of critical political education on Palestine. Most of my education about Palestine came through my grandmother and the stories of my grandmother. So it's been a question that I've been dealing with, and I'm thinking of ways in which we can create alternative mediums for critical political education, utilizing different forms of education and building upon my global education, but also global networks. So, for example, there's a rising hip-hop scene in Arub that hasn't been sufficiently and efficiently contextualized. What does that mean for the Palestinian struggle? How does it fit with the current global discourse around hip-hop and the messaging of hip-hop? So this is, for example, one of the questions that I'm trying to push our community to reflect upon. Another question would be the intersectionality, the discourse of intersectionality that BDS and Students for Justice in Palestine have been definitely functioning within. So how do I, as a Palestinian activist who has had the luck and opportunities to get exposed to such conversations, how do I bring them back home? So I'm thinking now of starting a community center after I finish my master's in Arub, and then try to start these conversations and hopefully, see how that goes and see if we can expand that to other localities within Palestine.
It's the voice of Hashim Abu Shama. Hashim, we last spoke to you about a year and a half ago during the Earlham College push for divestment from corporations that profit from Israel's occupation. Mm-hmm. You were the Student Senate co-president and a member of the BDS Earlham campaign. Part of the campaign was to push the university, as you said, to stop silencing Palestinian students on campus. Can mm-hmm. you talk about your work with the BDS campaign there and what the campaign looks like a year and a half later?
Yes, so I've been involved in the BDS campaign since my freshman year. And one of our main focuses has been the divestment campaign to pressure Erlam's administration to divest their money from companies that are complicit in the Israeli occupation, namely the three companies, Caterpillar, HP and Motorola Resolution. We passed a resolution last year, and it was passed by consensus. So everyone in the Senate actually agreed to the resolution. And then the resolution was presented to the Board of Trustees a semester after as part of the overall student government report to the Board of Trustees. And expectedly and unsurprisingly, the Board of Trustees didn't comply and didn't take our concerns as student representatives seriously. So that was followed with conversations with the student government and also a shift of focus. We tried to do more activities that try to raise awareness about the situation in Palestine. We focused a little bit more on the boycott element of the campaign, trying to stir more conversation among the student body to create even more pressure on the administration. That was successful. We ended up de-shelving the shelves of the coffee shop from Sabra Hummus, another example of companies that are not only complicit, but also benefiting from the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And to be very honest with you, now we're in a very critical position where we have organized the student body to make a very strong political statement to the administration and the Board of Trustees, and they haven't complied. So what do we do now? But our hopes are high. Erlam has just selected a new president who's an African-American, the first in the history of Erlam. We acknowledge that it's pretty late for a liberal arts college like Erlam to choose its first president of color. It's been more than 200 years. But with that said, I think there are a lot of hopes. He was actually involved in the BDS South Africa campaign in the 1980s at Erlam, and he did speak about that in his activism. At Erlam as a student, and he was actually the co-president of the student government when he was a student at Erlam. So we're hoping that he will actually be more representative of the concerns and the collective voices of the student body.
And what are your thoughts as the BDS movement expands, especially on college campuses, and especially under this this climate now, that the U.S. Senate just passed unanimously passed a bill seeking to really criminalize supporters and activists within the BDS movement on college campuses. What are your thoughts about how students, especially Palestinian students, are able to organize under these kinds of conditions that are slowly expanding across the United States?
So let me start by saying that I've always been a big believer in the BDS movement. But these clashes or responses from administrative politicians in the U.S. I think reaffirm me that BDS is actually making progress. We're getting to a place where we're actually pushing people who are formulating policies around foreign policy and around Israel and Palestine. So I think it presents a major challenge for BDS, but also gives us a message that we're breaking through a new ceiling now. So that's where I seek my hope from in this very tough moment. I think one of the mechanisms in which activists can actually protect themselves in this moment is building coalitions and continuing the work of building coalitions with other marginalized groups. For us at Erlam, it's been very instrumental and educational to continue to build coalitions with the Black Student Union, with Spectrum, with Students for Free Tibet. So I think that kind of creates a unity that's powerful. But at the same time, it gives us a lot of challenges to work on. Because for me, I think one of the biggest challenges is how do I bring this conversation of intersectionality to the larger conversation, and how do I make it relevant to people at home? So I think I take it very seriously when I talk about intersectionality and solidarity. I don't see it only as a strategic tactic. I also see it as a commitment to each other's struggles. And this is exactly what I'm trying to do with the idea of community center in the future after I graduate from Oxford.
Well, Hashim Abu Shama, again, congratulations. Mabruk on your Rhodes Scholarship.
Thank you. And
we look forward to your work, of course, for years and years to come. Thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Visit us online at electronicintifada.net or follow us on Twitter at Intifada. The Electronic Intifada.
Intifada Electronic.
Intifada Electronic.
Electronic Intifada.
Radical. Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present investigative journalist and author Greg Palast, who explains why he believes the Republican Party fought so hard to stop the Green Party-initiated vote recounts in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Former health insurance executive Wendell Potter, who discusses the health insurance chaos and political fallout that will likely result from the Trump and Republican Party pledge to repeal Obamacare. And Marty Hayden of the group Earth Justice, who talks about the coal mining stream protection rule recently issued by the outgoing Obama administration and the Trump GOP threat to overturn it. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After months of controversy, Saudi Arabia has admitted using UK-manufactured cluster bombs in Yemen against Houthi rebels who are backed by Iran. The Saudi admission has raised questions about British control of cluster munitions that were sold to the Saudi kingdom in the late 1980s. Ratified the 2010 International Cluster Munitions Convention that bans the use of deadly and indiscriminate cluster munitions. Amnesty International first exposed the Saudi use of cluster bombs in Yemen a year ago. Recently, British TV networks ITV and Sky News confirmed those reports. In November, Britain's Tory government began a full-scale inquiry into the Saudi military's use of cluster bombs in Yemen. As a result, the Obama administration has pulled back from planned arms sales to the Saudi kingdom that included airdrop munitions and high-tech precision-guided bombs. Yemen's 20-month-old civil war has killed over 10,000 civilians and triggered a full-scale humanitarian crisis. Amazon, the giant online retailer, is increasing its market share with promises of free delivery and new services for its lucrative Amazon Prime customers. At the same time, Amazon has, since the Great Recession, won over $600 million in subsidies from taxpayers to help finance its new network of warehouses. Over the last 5 years, Amazon has transformed itself by offering new services to high-end consumers. The company has largely abandoned its earlier business model of locating its warehouses in low-tax states and avoiding paying sales taxes. But now, Amazon is building up its infrastructure in the Northeast and Midwest to tap affluent customers.
Over the last year, Amazon has won $240 million in tax concessions in Connecticut, Florida, Minnesota, Texas, and Massachusetts. The local tax breaks come as Amazon has grown into the eighth largest retailer, by sales, in the nation. Amazon is using its enormous economy of scale and its ability to lower prices to drive out smaller competitors. Just before Christmas, Ohio Governor John Kasich signed a bill that blocks a scheduled referendum on a higher minimum wage in Cleveland. The planned May 2017 vote, organized by labor advocates, would have eventually raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour. 35,000 Cleveland residents work full-time, making less than $15 an hour, and half of those working poor are African Americans. The legislation signed by Kasich caps the state minimum wage at $8.10 an hour and bars any municipality from authorizing a higher wage. According to Think Progress, 20 states have preempted higher local minimum wage laws. Moreover, 15 states have also blocked local paid leave laws. But despite this conservative campaign, 21 minimum wage increases were approved across the country in 2016. Wisconsin's Republican governor, Scott Walker, initiated the wave of conservative preemption when he signed a law in 2011, blocking cities from passing laws requiring paid sick leave time, which overturned sick leave benefits in Milwaukee. Preemption strategies were quickly adopted by the right-wing organizations such as the National Restaurant Association and the Koch brothers-financed American Legislative Exchange Council. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
With Donald Trump's presidential election victory defying most pollsters' forecasts, Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein's pursuit of a vote recount in the historically Democratic states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania were welcomed by many in the nation suffering from political shock. Of the three states, Wisconsin was the only one to complete a recount, financed by small donors across the U.S. who contributed to a fund set up by Stein. However, Republican legal objections succeeded in blocking the completion of a vote recount in Michigan and prevented a vote recount in Pennsylvania from ever getting started. Although the recount in Wisconsin didn't change the state's results, Stein said the process she initiated revealed deep flaws in state systems for administering voting and verifying results. She cited election irregularities in Michigan, including more than 75,000 uncounted ballots, as evidence of the need to re-examine that state's election outcome and the urgency for reform of state laws that make verification of voting results more difficult. Greg Palast is an investigative reporter and award-winning author who uncovered the Republican voter purge in Florida that led to what many charge was a stolen election in 2000 that put George W. Bush in the White House. In his new documentary film titled The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, Palast investigates a multi-state system known as CrossCheck that he says was employed to wrongly purge some 1.1 million Americans of color from the voter rolls of GOP-controlled states. Your reporter spoke with Palast, who reports on the results of his most recent investigation into the Green Party-initiated recounts in the three Rust Belt states and the Republican Party effort to stop them.
I think that the recount was sabotaged in Wisconsin, sabotaged and stopped in Michigan, halted in Pennsylvania, because they knew what would happen if you actually counted all the votes. And this is the dark secret of American democracy. We don't count all the votes. There are officially, this is not, you know, Greg Palast finger in the wind type stuff. We have an agency called Elections Assistance Commission, which tracks the number of votes and the number of no votes, the number of ballots which are never counted. They call it spoiled. And the problem is that if you're black, the chance your vote will spoil for a technical reason is 900% higher than if you're white. And we saw that happen in Michigan, in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, North Carolina, Arizona, and Florida. That's quite a bit. All of those Trump so-called victories, margins there, may not be victories if you pulled ballots out of the electoral dumpster and counted them. We don't count all the ballots in America. And no nation can count all ballots. There's always some that are spoiled and legitimately destroyed and unreadable. But in America, it's in the millions, and it is deliberately biased against voters of color. That is our nasty secret. Jill Stein told me that she, when I met up with her in Detroit, she said she expected to find Russian hackers and stuff like that that may have bent the vote. And she said, what I found instead, and this is a quote from her, what I found instead was a Jim Crow election, black votes uncounted that made the difference. So that's why they had to stop her from counting those votes.
Greg, how typical is it that you'd have 75,000 plus votes in Flint and Detroit, as you described, that went uncounted? If you go back to presidential election years like 2012, 2008, and so on.
Just in Florida, 2000, 181,000 ballots were rejected as uncountable for hanging chads and similar reasons. 181,000 ballots. So 75,000 ballots in Michigan, that's not unusual. And where are those ballots not counted? Generally, they're not counted in black areas, as the U.S. Civil Rights Commission found in both its nationwide and state studies. Why in Detroit? Well, remember, and Flint. Remember, Detroit and Flint are bankrupt cities. They were taken over by the Republican governor, who appointed what he called emergency managers, who then slashed the budgets of these cities. First, they slashed the budget for the water supply of Flint. And infamously, they poisoned the children of Flint. When you're talking about people to save a few bucks who have no problem poisoning children, the idea that they would poison the election machinery is nothing. What they did was something simple. The black officials begged the state to let them spend the money to get new voting machines, because their old voting machines, their ancient voting machines, just didn't work. They were broken. And in fact, on election day, 87 machines broke down in Detroit. 87. Each of those machines supposed to tabulate thousands of votes. What happened to those votes?
What are the dangers you see in the Trump administration as it takes power, with its chosen Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, with a horrendous record of racist statements and prejudicial actions as a senator, and the appointment of a Supreme Court justice or justices that may fall to Trump, as well as federal judges that he'll have, from what I heard, an estimated 100 of who he'll get to choose?
Yeah, two things immediately. Number one, Jeff Sessions says we're going to eliminate the Voting Rights Act. Trump could not have been elected if it wasn't for the gutting of the Voting Rights Act in 2013, but it's still hanging in there, the Voting Rights Act. That is going to be removed utterly. And if they can't remove it utterly, though I think that they will, they simply won't enforce it. Because right now, you've got the mob, you've got the vote heist mafia, is running the FBI, literally, is running the enforcement division of the Civil Rights Enforcement Division, Voting Rights Enforcement Division of the Justice Department, which will now become an injustice department. It's true that Obama basically was frozen in place, and his Justice Department was pretty much useless throughout his 8 years. You know, one thing is the jalopy not moving. The other thing is for it to race in reverse at high speed. We're going to be back in 1955 when it comes to voting. I'm telling you that right now. We're going to be coming back to that same situation where we're going to be for black people, and now the new black people known as students and Asian Americans are going to have a heck of a time trying to vote. Students, Asian Americans, African Americans, Latinos, look out in those GOP-controlled states. We're going back to the 50s.
That was investigative reporter and author Greg Pallast, whose new documentary film is titled The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. Find links to Pallast's investigations and related election analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Ever since the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010, known widely as Obamacare,
The Republican Party has staged continuous rhetorical attacks on the health care law and held more than 60 votes to repeal the legislation. Now, with the election of Donald Trump to the White House and Republicans maintaining control of both the House and Senate, the party will be in position to destroy the legislation that, for all its flaws, has brought health insurance to more than 20 million Americans, many of them for the first time. The Affordable Care Act has reduced the number of uninsured Americans, although some 30 million still don't have coverage. ACA provisions include Medicaid expansion, health insurance marketplace coverage, and changes in private insurance that allows young adults to stay on their parents' health insurance plans and requires insurance plans to cover people with pre-existing health conditions. While Republicans are eager to repeal Obamacare and promise to replace it, the GOP has no viable public proposals to do so. Trump says he would permit health insurance companies to sell policies across state lines, encourage more people to enroll in health savings accounts, and give states almost total control over Medicaid through block grants. But none of these ideas will make up for the loss of subsidies for working families that would be lost under the ACA, and the rise of health care costs will continue unchecked. Your reporter spoke with Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive and best-selling author, who discusses the health insurance market chaos and political fallout that he says will likely result if Trump and the Republicans carry out their pledge to repeal Obamacare.
They feel that it's important for them to pass something because they've led their voters to think that Obamacare is the worst thing ever and that they are going to repeal it and replace it with who knows what. It will not be as easy as they think. And one of the things I found during my time on Capitol Hill during the debate on Obamacare was that lawmakers have a very shallow understanding of how the health insurance marketplace really works. And I'm sure that they're getting a crash course right now from my former colleagues in the health insurance business. And they're undoubtedly coming to realize that undoing Obamacare in ways that they have said they plan to do it can really create enormous chaos and frankly, a meltdown of the individual healthcare marketplace, which I think they very well could do.
Two of the features of Obamacare, or the ACA, that people generally like is the fact that young people 26 years of age and younger can remain on their parents' health insurance plans, and also the important fact that insurance companies now cannot deny people for pre-existing conditions, can't deny
right.
their insurance. And we hear that the individual mandate, that's a big part of the Obamacare program, the idea that you have to buy some kind of insurance or you're going to get hit with a tax penalty, is the mechanism by which these two features that people like remain in place. Donald Trump is on record saying he likes these two features as well. How can Obamacare's individual mandate be repealed and these benefits that people enjoy remain in place?
You really can't do that, and I'm sure that's what the lobbyists for the industry are telling him and the transition team and Republicans in Congress. And I think the leadership of the Republican Party in the House and the Senate probably understand that, but the rank and file is probably news to them that can't be done. And the problem is, when the Affordable Care Act was being debated, the insurance industry said, okay, sure, we will go along with doing away with pre-existing conditions so long as you include an enforceable individual mandate, a purchase to buy coverage. And the Obama administration and Congress went along with that. When he was campaigning for the presidency the first time, Obama was against the individual mandate, but he quickly came to realize after he was elected that you can't do away with pre-existing condition exclusions and without having an individual mandate. The market just will not work, and there's evidence of that in several states that have tried it in the past, Washington State, New York State, and Kentucky are three that come to mind, that all three tried to do this. They tried to force the insurance industry to accept all applicants, and they couldn't reject anyone. But they didn't have the individual mandate. And that created the, you know, the dreaded death spiral in every one of those states. Insurance companies began to leave the states, and premiums went sky high. And only the wealthiest and the sickest, quite frankly, who had money, were able to buy coverage.
Wendell, I've read some studies about the folks in the country that are benefiting from the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. And it turns out that some 80% of those benefiting are in the same demographic of white working class voters who went overwhelmingly to vote for Donald Trump.
Right.
What's the potential for political fallout here if Trump and Congress follow through on this pledge to get rid of Obamacare without any real viable replacement for it?
Well, there's enormous risk to the party. And I wrote a piece for Bill Moyers' website earlier this month, and I said that as they're coming to terms with what they might unleash if they do indeed pass a repeal bill without any thoughtful replacement, it can and probably will create a lot of uncertainty and chaos. And insurance companies don't like uncertainty. They don't like, believe it or not, they don't like risk. And so they will start fleeing the marketplace. And that will mean that a lot of people who voted for Trump and Republicans will begin to get notices ultimately that their coverage is being canceled. Now, I'm sure some of the busiest people in Washington right now are Republican PR people. They undoubtedly are creating PR strategies for various scenarios of what will happen if Congress does this or that. And you know, the worst case scenario is that the market does melt down and people are not able to get the coverage that they've had. There was, as you may remember, the Republicans made a huge deal out of the fact that some people had to change their policies after Obamacare was passed. We're talking about, you know, relatively few people compared to the people, you know, the over 20-some million who would be in that predicament if they go forward with a bill to repeal Obamacare. And they've been saying that they don't think it's all that necessary to pass a replacement bill at the same time. That's not something that will work. I think the reason they're saying that is that they don't have a plan. They don't know what to do. They've talked over the past few years about a few, you know, they brought out a few things that make for good talking points, but they just simply, they don't constitute good health policy, and they will not work in terms of actually replacing the Affordable Care Act and providing people with affordable coverage.
That was Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive and best-selling author of Deadly Spin and Nation on the Take. Find links to Potter's articles in his new investigative online journal, Tarbell, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the waning days of the Obama administration, an environmental regulation that was years in the making was finalized in December. The Stream Protection Rule, which will take effect on January 19, 2017, was designed to protect streams and other bodies of water in Appalachia from pollution and even obliteration by mountaintop removal coal operations. The new measure is an improvement over a previous regulation implemented during the George W. Bush era, but according to some environmentalists, it does not go far enough. To make matters worse, the incoming Trump administration and the Republican-controlled Congress have the power to repeal it because it was promulgated so late in Obama's tenure, which is something Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has already promised to do. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Marty Hayden, Vice President for Policy and Legislation with the group Earth Justice, which has represented opponents of mountaintop removal coal mining, who have campaigned to safeguard air and water quality. Here, Hayden explains what the Stream Protection Rule does and doesn't do, and what's likely to happen to the measure when Donald Trump takes office.
In 1977, Congress passed the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act. That's the law that regulates coal mining. Part of that law prohibited coal mines from causing material damage to surface waters and groundwater. In 1983, the Reagan administration created the stream buffer zone rule, which prohibited mining within 100 feet of streams. Now, the problem with that was essentially never really enforced by the states. In 2008, President George W. Bush did his own rule to replace the Reagan rule, and his rule literally just said that they should minimize direct disturbance to the extent deemed reasonable to streams, which for all practical purposes was so vague to be unenforceable. Now, we and other groups sued that rule, and federal court threw it out in 2014. That is what led the Obama administration to put out the rule that just came out. Now, compared to the Bush rule, this is better, but it could have been much better. It's actually a modest step forward. The positive things it does is require improved baseline monitoring and data collection, both from the chemical side and the biological side of what the impacts of mountaintop removal coal mining are in the region, and hence would allow communities access to information about what is in their water, which they don't have today. The other improvement that it has is a requirement that the companies have to rebuild the streams and restore the stream function. That's primarily through having enough of a financial bonding requirement that they can afford to do that. The Obama administration kind of left a lot of things on the table in this role as well. Kind of most notable, I think, is while it still has what's called a stream buffer zone, it's really a buffer in name only, because it allows the industry is still going to be allowed to do valley fills within the buffer. Instead of having the Office of Surface Mining over at Interior impose clear requirements to protect the streams from mining, it leaves it to the states to fill in the blanks, which we know most of the mountaintop states aren't likely to be very vigorous about that.
So the new regulation is far from perfect, but better than what came before. But Marty Hayden, isn't it true that Congress can undo regulations finalized within a certain number of days of the end of a president's term, and this one falls within that time period?
Yes. It is called the Congressional Review Act. It allows Congress to pass a resolution of disapproval and veto, in this case, a rule. And if the president signs that veto, then the rule is gone. At the beginning of a new Congress, it's anything that had not been published and transmitted to Congress within 60 legislative days of the end of the session, which this rule, obviously, having just come out in December, would be. Mitch McConnell has already said he intends to do that.
In the end, whether this rule is repealed or not, how much difference will it make?
This rule, and plus, more importantly, I think the ability to revisit this rule, you know, in a future administration to strengthen it is very important. Mountaintop removal, it's not just that we're blowing up the mountains and causing deforestation and burying headwater streams. We're hurting people. They are, you know, a tremendous source of toxic pollution, both in water and air, that is hurting the people in the communities that surround these facilities. There have been numerous scientific studies over the last 6 years that it's a growing body of evidence that connects mountaintop removal with elevated rates of cancer, kidney disease, birth defects, cardiovascular and pulmonary disease, and other health problems. This is real. So controlling the pollution that's allowed to leave these sites at the end of the day is really important. And while this rule may not go far enough, we sure wouldn't want to lose the ability to do a strong rule in the future.
That was Marty Hayden, Vice President for Policy and Legislation, with the group Earth Justice. Learn more about Earth Justice and groups engaged in the campaign to stop mountaintop removal coal mining by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis
of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Rumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
For Dylan Roof, life. For Dylan Roof, the next few days and weeks of his young life will prove his most memorable. That's saying something, considering his slaughter of 9 souls in a black church in Charleston. For in the next few days and weeks, a jury will convene to decide whether he gets a death sentence or life. As someone who lived a lifetime on death row, my opposition is unequivocal. Even in a case such as this, my opposition to the state taking life doesn't falter. Even in this case of a witless white supremacist, a killer of 9 black Christian souls. If I know anything, I know death row. I've seen it drive men stark, raving mad. That said, my one opinion carries no real weight in this case, for unless I miss my guess, no juror will ever hear these words. They will decide his fate after he delivers his own closing arguments, which will hardly endear him to his jurors. A death verdict for Roof strengthens the repressive powers of the state and gives it the false aura of justice. If a death sentence fails, it helps slow the inherent injustice of the death penalty. It will help all of the men and women on death row. My decision to oppose death for Roof wasn't an easy one, but I believe it's the right one. No matter his beliefs, decades on death row, as with decades in solitary, are mind-frying experiences. Nothing he has experienced in his brief life can prepare him for such outcomes. For life in prison ain't no picnic. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. the magic of black music. As the deaths of two musicians recently demonstrates, black music is an art form that radiates freedom, and that radiation flows around the world. The death of Sharon Jones, lead singer for the Dap Kings, is of course tragic, in that she died of cancer at a relatively young age of 60. Yet her very being was a celebration of a stellar life force. A woman once told she was too black, too short, too fat to become a performer, did just that, and thrilled the hearts, ears, souls, business. In their horn-heavy, down-home standard, 100 Days, 100 Nights, Sharon Jones sings the lesson learned of a lover, a hard lesson, to pay attention to whom you lend your heart. Her determination led her to ignore agents and record producers and allowed her to set the stage afire with her blazing spirit. She freed herself and those she blessed with her voice and her powerful dark presence. Across the Atlantic, a Brit of Greek parentage did his own share of lighting the stage afire. Born Georgios Panayiotou in 1963 in East Finchley, North London, England. He became world famous as George Michael of Wham. Like many young Brits of his generation, simply read Boy George, for example, the beats, rhythms, and blues of black music struck their ears and moved them. These artists, raised on Motown sounds, constructed musics based on that dark ore and found fame and fortune. I think what they heard and what they found in black music was precisely what black musicians seeded it with, a yearning for freedom. For it was in the magical realm of music that black folks found their closest vision of freedom, to be, to become themselves. That energy was infectious and touched hearts and souls worldwide. Jazz soars in France, in Poland, in Japan. Rap has a deep foothold in London, in Paris, in Tokyo, in Soweto, in Harare, in Berlin, in Marseille, in every city where there are those who are oppressed. George Michael mixed black beats to fuel his pop hits and often used black producers and black musicians to enrich his work. When he came out as gay, he may have shocked the media, but it could be sensed in the subtexts of his songs and felt in his frenetic beats. Black musical beats and rhythms liberated him, freed him to be his self. Because in black music, one finds that yearning for freedom. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Presidential elections concentrate on the candidates, their words, their positions, and perhaps more importantly, their persona. Of course, we don't really know these people, but thanks to modern communications, we think we do. They are, in reality, familiar strangers. We see them on commercials or on televised interviews. But the real object in the political democracy should be the people. For without voters, how could elections be held? Average people are often ignored, while the rich are courted like lovers. What few pay attention to, however, isn't just average people, but the nature of politics. For the rich and powerful, they perform transactional politics, or to simplify, they treat their votes as part of a transaction and demand, for my vote, I want X. For poor and seemingly powerless people, they demand nothing. They practice affective or emotional politics. That means they vote based on how a candidate makes them feel. Being poor and seemingly powerless, they demand nothing, for they feel that they're unworthy of taking such a position. They want help, not power. In this way, class consciousness informs our political systems, and the poor and dispossessed are repeatedly disappointed with the politicians they vote for. That's because they vote for who they like, not what that candidate has promised them. This politics of betrayal has left many voters feeling like they can't trust any politicians, for they only lie, get in, and do what they want to anyway, right? They wonder, why can't anything work out? Because most people demand nothing. How can we be surprised when we get nothing in return? Affective or emotional politics is the politics of children. Transactional politics looks at politics coldly and makes demands. And if those demands aren't met, they exact a political consequence. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today's show is going to bring voices from a critical emergency organizing meeting to stop the Trump and Pence regime before it starts. This fascist regime, stop it before it starts. And that meeting was held on December 19th at New York City's Cooper Union. The meeting was attended by at least 260 people and watched online by over 200,000 people. A rich diversity of speakers talked about the danger people face, the potential for stopping the fascist regime before it's allowed to take power on January 20th, and they made plans for 4 weeks of actions coming up. The speakers included P.Z. Myers, a biologist and professor at the University of Minnesota Morris, author of the Pharyngula blog, Fran Luck, the executive director of Joy of Resistance Multicultural Feminist Radio at WBAI in New York, Isabel Cardenas, a Los Angeles immigrant rights leader, Jeremy Scahill, founding senior editor of The Intercept, the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, Chase Iron Eyes, part of the fight of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe against the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline, hip-hop artist Immortal Technique, known for his courageous political stance, Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Folks in New York City, Gloria Steinem, author and feminist activist, Pastor Doris Johnson from South Queens, and Imam Ayub Abdul-Baki, Justice Committee of the Islamic Leadership in New York. You can hear more of this entire event than what you're going to hear today by going to refusefascism.org, and I really, really recommend that you go there and watch the video. All right, there's a lot that we weren't able to include in this because of the limits of time and space, but I really advise everyone to go and listen to this, and especially, you know, check things out. For instance, Jeremy Scahill's comments during the event were very important and include a really scathing assessment of just who these Nazis are that make up the Trump-Pence regime. So we're going to start off now with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us.
If you are sick at heart, if you are outraged, if you are scared, if you are wondering what the hell just happened, how did we get into this place and what do we need to do about it, then you are in the right place. Welcome to the emergency organizing meeting to stop Trump and Pence before they come to power. Welcome to everybody here in New York City's Cooper Union, came out on this whole night, and welcome to everybody tuning in on live stream and gatherings around the country or on your own. Let me correct that. Nobody who is watching this is alone. We are in this together. My name is Sansara Taylor. I'm one of the co-initiators of the movement ReduceFascism.org. You will hear more about this tonight, and as you might have guessed by now, I am your MC for the evening. So we'll be going on this journey together. Very powerful voices are telling you that the fight is over, that Trump has won, that you should get used to pussy-grabbing and neo-Nazis, white supremacists and women haters, immigrant bashing, constitution shredding, and war crimes. Get used to science deniers and planet destroyers. Get used to theocrats. Get used to hate crimes. Get used to intimidation. Get used to being scared. Get used to being silent. Get used to it all. We are here tonight to say no. Trump and Pence are not in power yet. This fight is not over, and we are not done. We are not getting used to fascism. We are getting organized to stop it. We are here tonight because we know in our gut, in our soul, in our bones, that something very, very bad has just happened. But through the course of this evening, with the incredible way to stop it, to literally change the course of history. Tonight is going to be an evening of sober-eyed confrontation with terrifying truths. And tonight is going to be a summoning of audacious daring and courage, of strength and understanding, of unity and direction. Tonight is going to be a night of transformation. Each of us becoming, and all of us together becoming, a collective force that is bursting with diversity, but sealed in a unified determination to act decisively, to bring forward millions and millions to join us to stop Trump and Pence before they come to power. So again, I want to welcome you all. You are in the right place. I look forward to spending an evening with you. I look forward to spending the next 32 intense days with you. I want to introduce our first speaker. He flew out from Minnesota. He is a co-initiator of this effort. He is a developmental evolutionary biologist. He is a professor who is ominously on the right-wing watch list that was just created, something he's proud of. It makes us proud to have him with us. It's a very dangerous thing. He's been ranked one of the most popular science bloggers, actually the most popular science blogger and atheist blogger, alternately. His blog is called Ferangula. He is a passionate and talented popularizer of science, taking on notions like intelligent design and other things. I ask you to give a warm welcome, joining me in bringing to the stage P.C. Myers.
Well, hello, I'm glad you're all here. So, I'm standing here as a human being who is outraged by recent circumstances, just as every one of you is as well. I have no special qualities to make me uniquely representative or to warrant my presence on this stage. And if I had my way, we'd every one of us rise up and march together now in unified in our opposition. Fortunately, I think you'll have an opportunity to do that later. You'll have many opportunities to do that in this next month. So I feel a little bit humble here because I've been asked to say a few words for one small sector of the American experience. I am an educator and a scientist. As an educator and a scientist, in addition to as a human being, I am horrified. We have elected a post-truth president. Worse, he is actively anti-truth. He is the antithesis of everything reason and science stand for. So let me give you a few examples of Trump's anti-science stand. And all we have to do, fortunately, is look at his Twitter feed. So way back in 2014, he's been at this for a long time, there was an Ebola outbreak in Africa. And he wrote this appalling statement. He said, the U.S. cannot allow Ebola-infected people back. People that go to faraway places to help out are great, but must suffer the consequences. Think about the callous sensitivity in that remark. Not only should the innocents afflicted with this horrible disease be neglected, but the courageous medical professionals who went to their aid should be refused entry back into this country. Cowardice and an inhuman disregard for the lives of our best and bravest. Is this the man who we want to be our president?
No.
More recently, he just demonstrated gross ignorance. He wrote, autism rates are through the roof. Why doesn't the Obama administration do something about doctor-inflicted autism? So he's anti-vaccination. That's a well-supported, safe medical procedure that saves millions of lives. And he's against it because he denies the robust evidence that shows that it works and refutes any claim that it causes autism. He goes further and accuses doctors of conspiring to cause autism. This is destructive to the health of our people, but then it's clear that he has little interest in helping the needy. Is this the man who we want to be president of our country?
No!
Another example of inflammatory, dangerous conspiracy theories from the Twitter feed of Mr. Trump. The concept of global warming was created by and for the Chinese in order to make U.S. manufacturing non-competitive. That's unbelievable. Climate scientists are fundamentally unanimous in their agreement on this matter. The climate is changing. It is caused by rising concentrations of greenhouse gases. These gases are largely generated from human sources, from industry, from automobiles, from rising demand for energy produced from fossil fuels. This is a crisis, and we must respond and respond soon. Trump's response is to deny reality and describe the concern to yet another conspiracy theory and to blame a foreign power. This is dangerous madness. And again, I have to ask, is this the man we want to be president of our country?
No.
It's more than just what he has said. It's what he has already done. He has appointed an Exxon executive to be the Secretary of State. His administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency is a lawyer who has always sided with the oil, coal, and gas industry and wants to destroy the EPA. His Secretary of the Interior does not accept the science of climate change and wants to strip away safeguards to protect, well, the Interior. His Secretary of Energy is a man who declared his intention to destroy the office of Secretary of Energy, although he also forgot the name of the position during his campaign. I also have mentioned another enduring long-term threat. His Secretary of Education is someone who campaigns to impoverish and destroy public education. Apparently, ignorance is a virtue fascism wants to encourage. Is this the man we want to be president of our country?
No.
One last thing. These are not merely differences of opinion. Trump has embraced the fascist dream of enforcing his opinions with threats of violence. Recently, Michael Mann, a well-known and highly respected climate scientist, wrote about his experience with the thugs of the right wing, who have become bolder after the election. In a Washington Post opinion piece, he wrote this: "I have faced hostile investigations by politicians, demands for me to be fired from my job, threats against my life, even threats against my family. These threats have diminished in recent years as man-made climate change has become recognized as the overwhelming scientific consensus and as climate science has received the support of the federal government. With the coming Trump administration, my colleagues and I are steeling ourselves for a renewed onslaught of intimidation from inside and outside government. It will be bad for our work and bad for our planet." And then there have been threats of violence. I've received email warnings that the public will come after you, suggesting that I'll find myself 6 feet under and hoping to read that I had committed suicide. I can tell you that Michael Mann is not alone. I teach evolutionary biology and have likewise received threats of violence, death threats, promises to get me fired from my job, threats against my family. I have been placed on the professor watch list by far-right-wing propagandists because I took a strong stand against scientifically fallacious and ethically unconscionable racism promoted by my campus neo-Nazi propagandists. This is plainly fascism, and we have no choice. We must say no in the name of humanity. We refuse to accept a fascist America.
Administration and the work not only of decades but of literally generations
of trying to bring women out of the slough of incredible oppression that was under rule of law in the past is going to be set way, way back unless we stop it. You've heard of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Well, I'm going to call what women now face the three horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. They are, first of all, the Groper-in-Chief, Donald Trump himself, who's braggadocio about sexually assaulting women, because he could get away with it, has already led to numerous reported incidents of increased sexual harassment of women. Women are being grabbed by the crotch, by men and by boys, in his name. One report I've read really stands out for its symbolism. A woman in Penn Station rejected a man's advances and was told, quote, "I can't wait until Trump gets elected so I can force bitches like you to their knees." The word bitch itself, which is so often used to dehumanize women and as a precursor to violence against women, has been totally normalized by the Trump campaign. There have been Nuremberg-like rallies where hordes of people yell, "bitch, bitch, bitch," at his opponent Hillary Clinton and wore t-shirts saying the same thing. In Trump's America, the terrain for women is becoming very rough and very physically dangerous. And misogyny is, of course, intersectional, with women wearing hijabs or perceived as immigrants or women of color being doubly, triply in danger. Moving on, the second horseman of the Trumpocalypse is Mike Pence and the Christian evangelist that he represents. They want women to lose all autonomy in one of the most important decisions of her life, the right to decide when and if she bears children. Thousands of laws limiting this so far constitutional right to abortion have been passed in state after state so that abortion is now not obtainable in 90% of U.S. counties, although it is still on the books. There are all kinds of limitations, from forced vaginal ultrasounds to parental notifications to having to travel to other states to get abortions and spend money that you may not have on hotel rooms and all of the costs associated with that kind of travel. That will, of course, increase under a Trump administration. Trump has, of course, said that he will appoint Supreme Court justices overturning Roe v. Wade, that women should be punished for having abortions. Under Mike Pence in Indiana, we've had recently a law, well, we had the attempt, I should say, at a law that would force women to have funerals for fetuses, which is now just passed in Texas. Under Pence, Purvi Patel and other women have been jailed for essentially miscarriages. So we have that second horseman of the Trumpocalypse, that is Mike Pence. And we also have the right of conscience of the Christian right to deny women birth control in pharmacies and insurance plans. So the U.S. is in danger of becoming, like many countries in the world, one where abortion is not obtainable, and this results in 60,000 to 70,000 women a year dying of illegal botched abortions. We are about to join those countries if we do not stop it. Lastly, we have the third horseman of the Trumpocalypse. That's Paul Ryan and his henchman Tom Price, who is the new HHS, Health and Human Services chief. And that third face is austerity. As a result of male supremacist societies, women make less money than men and are more impoverished and more dependent on public entitlements such as Social Security, food stamps, welfare, Medicare, and Medicaid. These are all programs that Paul Ryan's Congress and Tom Price's HHS want to shrink, want to privatize, want to abolish. So the overall vision for what is to happen for women if this unbelievably anti-women misogynist administration takes shape and goes forward is a great leap backward into subservience, a.k.a. barefoot pregnant in the kitchen. And the modus operandi is, if you can't frighten them by threats of physical violence, you can force them to divert their energies into raising unwanted children, like pets, or you can starve them into submission, like Ryan and Price wanted to do. So, are we going to accept this? I, for one, am not. Thousands, millions of women and our allies are not. There is already a lot of organizing going on, and I want to commend this incredible effort, which all of us should be part of. We have got to stop them in their tracks as soon as we possibly can. Thank you.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're listening to voices from a critical emergency organizing meeting to stop the Trump and Pence regime before it starts. This is a Nazi regime, folks, and that meeting was held December 19th at New York City's Cooper Union. So now back to Sansara Taylor.
You just heard a lot of things, including a lot of things that have been going on, what gave rise to the situation and the extreme dangers of Trump and DeVos and Pence. This is a qualitative leap. This is fascism. There is no Democrat going to save us. There's nobody out there who's going to save us but us, the masses of people. Acting now, decisively, relying on ourselves, looking out to the millions who've been trained that it's not their place to take history into their own hands. It is our place. It is our duty right now. So to take us further on this journey tonight, I want to bring up somebody very special. He's somebody who joined with me just over a week ago in initiating this effort, and we are just getting started, and you need to be part of this. You need to be an active part of this, learning, contributing, and struggling with everybody you know and acting in ways you've never acted before. This man got his start in political life when he was drafted to fight in that genocidal war in Vietnam, and he said hell no. He refused to fight. In military prison for 2 years, 1 year of which was solitary, he came out unrepentant. He became a revolutionary, a member of the Movement for Black Liberation, and then a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party USA. He's a long-distance freedom fighter. He is a co-founder, together with Cornel West, of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. He is somebody who has been on the front lines from Ferguson to Baltimore to Standing Rock to Baton Rouge. Everywhere people are standing up and fighting back, and everywhere that the masses of people are being gunned down by police, Black and Latino people, and many other injustices, you can find Carl Dix. We are very honored to have him with us here.
Let's face what we're actually up against. There's a grave danger looming over humanity. Just a little more than a month from tonight, a fascist regime, the Trump-Pence regime, slated to take the reins of power in society, in this the most powerful country in the world. This will have dire consequences for humanity if it is allowed to happen. It isn't just that Trump campaigned on a program that included a lot of horrendous things. I mean, he promised to bar Muslims from entering the country, to surveil and deport them. He promised to build a wall on the border with Mexico, and to deport millions of immigrant workers. As he campaigned, he told lie after lie after lie, and he threatened those who opposed to expose his lies. He whipped up a lynch mob atmosphere at his rallies, targeting minorities, dissenters, or people in the press. And it isn't just that he's assembling a team of ghouls to carry out this program. Open white supremacists, religious fanatics, militarists, and the like. It's all of this taken together. This is a fascist regime. Now, the website Revcom.us has described fascism as follows: the exercise of blatant dictatorship by the bourgeois capitalist imperialist class, ruling through reliance on open terror and violence, trampling on what are supposed to be civil and legal rights, wielding the power of the state, and mobilizing organized groups of fanatical thugs to commit atrocities against masses of people, particularly groups of people identified as enemies, undesirables, or dangerous to society. This is what the Trump-Pence regime will mean to the country and to the world. We must not let this go down. We must act now and stop this regime before it gets started. And look, I know that this system, this capitalist imperial system, already inflicts unspeakable horrors on people in this country and around the world. I know that it's devastating the environment of the very planet that we live on. People here have been fighting that for years. I know that the U.S. wages wars for empire in the Middle East that have caused the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people and driven countless millions into exile. People like Jeremy have done tremendous exposure of that. I know that in this country, women are treated like sex objects and punching bags. I know that their right to choose to have an abortion is under attack. Many people in this room, including Fran and others, have been in this battle to fight to stop those attacks. I know that black people face savage oppression, mass incarceration, police terror, an education system that's geared to fail our youth, and more. And I stood shoulder to shoulder with a lot of you in the fight to stop that. I also know that record numbers of undocumented immigrants have been rounded up and deported under the so-called immigration President Obama. And some people here in this room have been fighting that over the past 8 years and more, too. But if this Trump-Pence regime is allowed to take power, all of these horrors will be greatly intensified. It will be like they got put on steroids. And this regime will move to violently repress, if necessary, or intimidate any and all who dissent against it, who promote critical thinking of reality. And they'll move to cut off all possibility of resisting all these horrors. We've seen this happen before. In Nazi Germany in the 1930s, in Chile and other countries in the 1970s. The whole society is drastically and dramatically changed, and the horrors that go down darken the sky is one story in putting. And it does so for a long time. If you want to understand this, here's another way to look at it. Let's look at what happened after the end of the Civil War here in this country. Now, slavery was abolished. Black people got the right to vote. Some black people got elected to positions in the government. And an education system was set up that gave black people access to education for the first time. This was a tremendous change. But it was also a tremendous shock, especially to white people in the South. And some of the people who voted for Trump ain't got over that shock yet. Some of them still think the Civil War got the side of wrong and they wish the other side had won. What followed was a period called Reconstruction. It wasn't paradise, but the black people were able to raise their heads and to make some gains. They had to do this against continued terror and resistance from white supremacists, but at least black people could contest this and fight. But then in 1876, after a disputed presidential election, Reconstruction was overthrown. The defeated forces of the Confederacy were allowed to take power back, and they used that power to change everything. They snatched back just about every right that black people had won, and they murdered thousands of black people in the process. And then they killed thousands more over the following decades with lynch mobs and other kinds of terror. They created a situation where every black person knew that at any time they could be killed by whites for any reason or no reason at all. This had dire consequences for black people for decades to come after that. See, and here I have to say that if you're one of these people who, like some of these misguided comedians who said, well, black people have survived worse than Trump, we'll get through this too, I got two things I want to ask you. One, why would you want to go through something like that again? One. Two, why wouldn't you want to stand up and join with others to act to stop it in the interest of all of humanity? So that's why I'm here tonight, and that's why we're all here, to stop a fascist regime from taking the reins of power in society. And the unity that we need to do this has to encompass tens of millions of people who see the importance of doing this. Now, a lot of y'all know me. I'm still the same guy. I'm a revolutionary communist. I'm a follower of Bob Fagan. Spent my life fighting to make revolution and bring it to being a radically different world. And I know that this is still what humanity needs to end the horrors of this system once and for all, and that making this revolution is possible. And right now, coming from that viewpoint, I see the need, the burning need, to throw in with everybody else to accomplish a goal that is far short of a revolution. And that goal is stopping the Trump and his regime before it gets started. And I see the need to do that because humanity needs to stop this regime to be able to fight for any kind of larger goal. So that's what we need to do. Now, how do we do it? To get into that, I want to read a paragraph from the plan issued by RefuseFascism.org. Imagine if people in the tens of millions filled the streets, powerfully declaring that this regime is illegitimate and demanding that it not be allowed to rule. The whole political landscape could be dramatically transformed. Every faction within the established power structure would be forced to respond. And all this could well lead to a situation in which this fascist regime is actually prevented from ruling. This is not some idle dream, but something which could be made a reality if all those who hate what is represented by this regime translate their outrage into firm determination and massive mobilization to create the conditions which make this possible. So that's what we need to do, and it begins right here tonight. Everybody in this room and everybody watching on the live stream has got to get involved in making this happen, starting now. We've got to get organized into this, and then we, all of us, have to go out and organize others into it, unleashing them to go out and organizing others still into it. And we've only got a month to do this, so we can't lose any time in making this happen. We've got to reach out in every way that we can to let others know that we need to mobilize millions to stop this fascist regime. You've got to talk about this at your workplaces. You've got to talk about this in your places of worship. You've got to talk about this in your communities. Students have an important role to play in this, to make it happen. I mean, if you're a college student, you can spend your winter break organizing this effort to stop the Trump-Pence regime from taking advantage of power. So you can also reach through your networks to other students, even if they aren't taking classes right now. And this is an effort that needs to go viral. And students can put their effort into making it go viral, spreading it everywhere through social media and in other ways. And the high schools are still in session, and they'll go back into session right after the holidays. So that's an arena where organizing to stop this regime can begin right now. Now look, the holidays are coming up, but this ain't going to be a break in this effort. It's got to be a time to get more people organized into it. Religious gatherings that take place during the holiday season need to be places where people hear about the need to act to stop this fascist regime and get organized into it. You have the family gatherings during the holiday? Well, a topic of discussion has to be the need to stop this Trump-Pence regime and how to do it and getting people organized into it. And then afterward, we got to come back together and take this no, which is the symbol of this effort, and the call for this effort to resist to another level, getting it out everywhere and raising the money needed to make this happen. Then on New Year's Eve, people need to take to the streets everywhere, being a living manifesto of the mass determination that exists broadly in society to act to stop this fascist regime. Every Trump property anywhere in the country and even anywhere in the world needs to have a demonstration out in front of it saying no to fascism on New Year's Eve. And that no symbol needs to be everywhere at the demonstrations, posted up and spread online, put up on the walls, and maybe somebody will even come up with a creative way for it to prominently appear in Times Square on New Year's Eve. Then, as January opens, the call to refuse to accept the fascist America is going to appear as an ad in a major publication like the New York Times. many other places, in print and online, broadly sounding the alarm on the danger that this regime poses for the country and the world, and calling on people to join the effort to stop it. And then, beginning with January 3rd, we've got to lead people into the street in mass actions. Mass actions that call to mind the way the people responded after the system refused to indict the cops who murdered Mike Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York. With people taking to the streets day after day, staying in the streets, disrupting business as usual. These actions also have to bring to mind Occupy.
Yeah.
With people in the streets day and night, standing together against injustice. We got to be doing this every day. We got to be growing as we do it, spreading the word, because we got to reach tens of millions, 100 million people with this. We got to have that many people knowing about it in order to get the millions of people in the streets that are going to be needed to do this. January 12 and 13, that's a day of school walkouts all across the country. College, that's got to be the day when, if you're in college, high school, even middle school, you step out on that day because you don't want your future to be having to endure being ruled by a fascist regime. Then we're up to the Martin Luther King holiday weekend. That's the weekend when people got to pour into D.C. on a whole other level in powerful actions aimed at stopping this regime. Not just going down and registering that you don't like it and go home, but going down there to act to stop it and staying in D.C. Don't go back home at the end of the weekend. Stay in D.C. Demonstrate all over the city. Disrupt the business as usual of that town all through that week. And as we do that, call on others to join us. Join us in acting and disrupting the business as usual to stop this fascist regime from taking power. And look, those of you that can't get to D.C., okay, well, you try to get there, but if you can't make it, act wherever you are. Be in the streets together with us, even if you're geographically separate from us, acting together to do the same thing, to stop this illegitimate regime from taking power. See, and all of these efforts taken together would be aimed at creating an unprecedented political crisis in society that could lead to the stopping of this illegitimate regime. Now, this ain't something that's going to be easy, but it is possible. I mean, I've been around a while. You can see that by that gray here. During my lifetime, presidents have been driven from office, including this country. LBJ didn't just decide he didn't want to run again. It was the crisis and the chaos in society that forced that decision. But let's get more recent so that it's in everybody's memory. Let's go back a few years to Egypt. They had an illegitimate regime. Millions of people took to the streets, Tahrir Square, and stayed in the street until that regime was toppled. Because, see, millions of people can come suddenly and seemingly out of nowhere when the dam bursts. We got to burst that dam and act to stop this regime. I'm going to read again that paragraph from the plan issued by RefuseFascism.org. Imagine if people in the tens of millions fill the streets, powerfully declaring that this regime is illegitimate, and demanding that it not be allowed to rule. The whole political landscape would be dramatically transformed. Every faction within the established power structure would be forced to respond. And all this could well lead to a situation in which this fascist regime is actually prevented from ruling. This is not some idle dream, but something which could be made a reality if all those who hate what is represented by this fascist regime translate their outrage into firm determination and massive mobilization to create the conditions which make this possible. For this to happen, we all need to organize on another level. We need to become the organizers of organizers of organizers. We need to throw our all in on this for the next month and more. Because just think what it would have meant if people had been able to join together to stop Hitler before his regime got started. Think of the difference it would have made for humanity. Well, I'm not trying to minimize what Hitler did, but today we're facing a fascist regime that's determined to institute a fascist rule with a finger on the nuclear buttons, aiming to make America first. We can stop this if we fight hard, creatively, and with unity. And the future of humanity may depend upon our success. Thank you, Mr.
That was Carl Dix, founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
They say sing what you know, but I've sung what they want. Some folks do what they're told, but baby, this time I won't. When I look through that door, I know the truth from lie. Some things I've done before I can't justify. There are kings in my past, things no one can be proud of. But I stand in the light I've cast and turn away from any lack of love. Oh, when I walk through that door, I say, here I go. You see me and nothing more. I'm singing what I know better. I know better.
Welcome back. That was I Know Better from John Legend and his new album, Darkness and Light. We've got two more segments from the emergency organizing meeting to stop the Trump and Pence regime before it starts. First, we'll hear from Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Books, New York City. And finally, we'll hear some concluding comments from Sansara Taylor.
No! A month of resistance. We're going to make this whole country feel the power of no. And we're gathering here today at Cooper Union, and people are watching around the country and around the world, because tens of millions of people are in anguish about what this will mean for the future. We've heard quite a bit about that tonight, and you just heard from Carl Dix on the plan. Those of you here tonight, and those who have signed the call, and those of us who have initiated this, are here, as Carl said, to organize the organizers of the organizers. Speaking of tens of millions of people getting out in the streets and staying in the streets, cannot just be nice rhetoric. It cannot just be wishful thinking. People need to understand that you cannot wait out fascism. That the time to organize against it is before it starts. I thought Carl brought this home. People need to know that there is a way to act on this basic truth. And tonight, each of you has a solemn responsibility to be a part of mobilizing millions. So no. The Trump-Pence regime must not attain power. They must not have the authority to curtail and potentially even to eliminate the right to dissent. And no, we will not let these lying thugs drastically undermine what is actually true and the people's access to information through their bullying, intimidation, and outright suppression of journalism, science, and the art. No! The full power of the USA must not be wielded to enforce the midnight Twitter ravings of Donald Trump and the Twitter swarming of the fascist minions that he leads. No, we must not let Donald Trump use the bully pulpit of the presidency and the force of the state to give back into the vigilantism of those who would be his stormtroopers, moving to suppress immigrants, blacks, Latinos, LGBTQ people, and anyone outside their fascist white power world. They are trying to bludgeon this into place, and they will do it fast. There is history to learn from, and history that must not be repeated. So know, tonight we will start organizing. You look around the room, and it's so wonderful that you all came out tonight on a free day live stream. How are we going to make this road to millions? How are we not going to allow the reins of state power to get into the clutches of this Trump fence regime? There's a lot of people saying we have to step up our struggle for justice. There's many people who have a vision of a better world. I just have to say to you tonight that if that's where you're coming from, you cannot imagine how much more difficult that's going to be under a fascist regime. You must understand that and what kind of change it makes, and let it not be the case that we failed to do everything we could to stop it. Again, I'm going to say, we must not fail to do everything we can do in this month to stop that. And we means you, and we means all of us. Everyone who's listening, everyone here, must become organizers. You have to reach out and arouse people. You have to get into what it is that we are facing and reach into the hearts and the thinking of millions of people. 2 weeks ago, Sansara and Carl and I initiated this plan, and we quickly got some other people on board. But I want to speak to you frankly that part of what inspired us is that we were making plans. We were doing things at Revolution Book, 65 defiant days. But we looked at everything we were doing and we said it wasn't up to what we are facing. It wasn't up to what all these diverse political forces are doing. And there's lots of people organizing, lots of important efforts. But if we stopped and thought about what this is really going to be, we had to confront the fact that none of it was going to stop the fascism. In fact, some of it was even slated to take part after it was started. This is not sufficient. It's important, but it needs to be brought together in a way to stop this. And I want to thank those of the speakers who came out on such short notice and all of you who came out. And I want to say that that has to be the pace of things. This urgency is what needs to characterize every day from here to January 20th. No, as Carl said, these holidays must not be your normal holiday. These are not normal times. We must not allow anything to be normal because there is nothing normal about Donald Trump and the fascist regime he wants to bring to power. So yes, step one, as Carl said, is going to be to turn this Hanukkah, Christmas, and for those of you who have these contentious atheist family gatherings, into organizing sessions where you get out with your relatives and start doing things around this. You need to go talk to your religious leaders and your community leaders right now to get on board with this, to lead people out of the mosque, out of the synagogue, out of the church. Take to the streets. Stand in silence. Make a lot of noise. Either one. All of it. That's what we need. These no signs, you have them in your packet. These have to proliferate. They have to be everywhere. Organize vigils. Organize marches. Make it known so that millions can start seeing this sign. Every lamppost, every office, every coffee shop, everywhere. High schools, colleges. No, all fundraisers. This is very important. There was a big applause when Carl said we should put an ad in the New York Times. That's tens of thousands of dollars, but it can't start with or stop with the New York Times. We have to be in the internet, and that too is expensive. Think about what it's going to cost to conduct Occupy-type protests all across the country, and especially in Washington, D.C. So over the holidays, this is the time to raise really big money to make this possible. Stop and think about it. What if you do, and what if we don't? If you organize this, you raise money and spread this word among thousands and tens of thousands and ultimately hundreds of thousands of people, this can be done. Do not underestimate the power of no. I believe that this is a time when a two-letter word can express and give shape to the will of millions of people. And let the people who are anguishing right now about Trump-Pence administration, let all those who are seething with anger and rage, who are starting to organize and think about life under a fascist regime, know that they are not alone and that there actually is a plan and a way to stop this. Let them see that no. Let them have that as an expression of their feelings that this regime is illegitimate, and immoral, and be in part enabling them to know that there is a way out of this dystopia before it starts. And yes, let those in power see and feel this no everywhere. Let it be the case that there's nowhere they can turn where this isn't coming up. Organize. There's no one but the people in this room and the people listening who can do this. We must become millions, and we must become millions in a matter of weeks. Protesting every day and every night, and fairly soon staying through the night, not just for one day, not just for a week, but until this regime is unseated, or prevented from being seated.
As you have seen tonight, we are people of faith, and we are atheists. We are revolutionaries. We are Democrats. Some of us are radicals. Some of us are pacifists. Some of us are in between. Some of us are in Standing Rock. Some of us are in New York City. Some of us are tuning in online. We make up a tremendous diversity, and frankly, we need to get so much more diverse, so much broader, so many more millions. And I want to just reiterate, in one moment, we're bringing everybody back on stage, and we're going to send off together. But if you are a student, you have the mission of your generation. You have to rouse your generation now. If you fought in the 1960s, if you sat in, if you Freedom Rode, if you stopped the war, if you burned your draft card, if you said hell no, get back out here. If you are like the growing numbers of Jewish voices with families and memories of the tattoos on the arms of people who were put in concentration camps, if you're part of a fraction who can tell that story because so many were lost, raise your voice now and do not let anybody sit back. If you are like the Japanese Americans who just did a march through downtown LA, who said, we remember the internment camps, and we will stand with our Muslim sisters and brothers. You need to bring that energy into this now. If you are giving money to all the important groups that fight for abortion rights and reproductive justice, who fight for civil rights and for the movement for Black lives, if you are giving for people who are doing services for immigrants who have to endure the horrors and the terror that is rippling, shockwaving through immigrant communities right now, you are right to do it, but think of the difference. To give everything you can right now to stop this, not to try to survive it, because millions will not survive it. Most of you here and most of you watching know you're not Rosa Parks, and know you're not the four who sat down at a lunch counter, and know you're not the ones who led and started Standing Rock, and know you didn't do all those things. Some of you did. But a lot of you didn't, but you know what? None of them did it before they did it. Right now, history is calling, and it's calling you. It's calling you. It's calling every one of us. And nobody here, don't let yourself tell yourself that myth, that lie, that inexcusable rationalization that I'm just one person, that I don't have significance, that no one listens to me. If you tell the truth, if you tell the sober, cold-eyed, terrifying truth, and you are willing to put your body behind it, put your name behind it, put your stature behind it, then you will rouse the sleeping, the terrified, the anguish. There are tens of millions of us who are looking for direction right now. You will rouse them, and you need to become a leader of them, an organizer of them, and we will help you. We have different people with much experience who are in this movement. We're building a national office. Move to New York and volunteer. Sign up here and volunteer. Organize where you're at. We have 32 days. And what you do in the next 32 days will have a greater bearing on the future of humanity and the planet than almost anything you could imagine doing if we sit back in 32 years after this regime, if we allow it. And that's not an exaggeration. Andy Z gave the analogy to Hitler. Many people, that's what I'm going to close with, but many people have heard and many more need to hear and take to heart the essential lesson that Pastor Martin Niemöller gave. He did not resist the Nazis. He ended up in a concentration camp for 8 years. He said, first they came for the communists, but I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists. Then they came for this one. By the time they came for me, there was no one left to speak up. That is a lesson we have to take on board now. But the other thing that I want to quote from him, very few people have heard. And he said, listen, he spent his life after he survived the concentration camps. He traveled the world. And he said, if we had risen up in the beginning, before Hitler crushed the resistance, before they jailed people and executed and tortured communists and others who were protesting and dissenting and put a chill throughout society, if we had stood up, he said, maybe 30 or 40,000 of us would have lost our heads. But think of what we would have prevented. Now, I'm not trying to get anybody hurt, but I'm trying to stop a world of hurt. And no price is too high to pay right now to stop with this fascist administration, with this fascist regime, with this theocratic, war criminal, genocidal, woman-hating, vicious regime has in store.
All right, that was Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper. Once again, the website for all this is refusefascism.org. Their Facebook page is also refusefascism.org. And you can go there for events all around the country, coming up on New Year's Eve and continuing on throughout the month. On Twitter, it's at refusefascism and the hashtag of NoFascistUSA. And very important, you can watch the video of the entire emergency meeting at refusefascism.org. And you can really get a sense of the breadth of the people involved in this and the need for so many more others, just like yourself, to get involved. And that brings us to the end of yet another show and another year. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer, Kiana Williams, and all of you for tuning in throughout this year. And if you'd like to write to me, comment, ask questions, or volunteer to help produce the show, you can do that by writing to me at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. You can also friend me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter. We're going to go out now with I Gotta Go from the Rolling Stones and their new album, Blue and Lonesome. Talk to you again next week.